We left off at the experience of witnessing the every sphere in closest backing changing, becoming a space, and space becoming a sphere. We'd been through discovering what the shapes of spaces between the spheres were. They were concave, vector equilibrium, concave octahedron. And I'd pointed out to you that the original, the vector equilibrium itself, then could go convex or concave, and the spheres I see then as the convex forms. Remember, vector equilibrium is using the most space in the universe, and all the things happen by contracting, so that when its edges, vectors, became curved, they reached a lesser distance. So these spheres in closest packing are actually in a, they produce what you call the isotropic vector matrix. The centers of each one are equidistant from one another, but produces a isotropic vector matrix whose chord length, the vector length, is a little less than the length of the vector equilibrium before all this starts. I think I'd point out to you that everything goes on inside the vector equilibrium. I'm convinced it's what goes on within the nucleus. And everything that goes on outside the vector equilibrium is what goes on in the chemistry of the associating of atoms into molecules. This is the internal affairs of the atom. Incidentally, just saying that the World War One, I mentioned to you the other day, they had physics, and there was something called electricity in addition to physics, mostly mechanics. And after World War One, suddenly the electron became the greatest importance. So physics was really electronics. And then World War Two saw physics become nuclear physics. And we saw the physicists and the chemists then getting crossing lines with one another, and the chemists and the biologists crossing lines with one another. So that after World War II at MIT, they decided to have a sorting this out, and they decided from there on that chemistry was now dealing with atoms, but the chemistry was dealing with external affairs of the atoms, and the physicists were dealing with internal affairs of the atoms. So the kind of things that go on inside my vector equilibrium, these contractions and so forth, I am assuming really are the internal affairs of the atom. But I just want you all to remember then that as the vector equilibrium contracting, and it's contracting by virtue of its edges becoming either convex or concave. If it's become concave, they become the spaces between the spheres. If they become convex, they become the spheres. And the spaces occupy same position. If you had a complex of cubes, many cubes stacked up on a layer after layer, all tightly packed, if you're looking at like a checkerboard, every other cube was black and then white, black and white, then you'd have the space, the whites that would be the spaces, and the blacks would be the spheres. So when this transformation occurs, then the white then becomes the sphere and so forth. I want you to have that feeling about what's going on here quite strongly. And the model that I photographed made it possible to demonstrate that is still in existence in Cambridge, and someday we hope to have a better model made, fresh one today. In respect to our whole experience together and my starting and operating entirely spontaneously and finding my way in, not knowing just what I was going to say as we started, I have gradually found now what it is I have said, and I can remember all the things. We've now done approximately 20 hours, and now I can see, having done the 20 hours, I really feel the things that I'm going to have to do in order to be able to be complete as we would like to be. I'm hoping I'll be able to do it in the available further 20 hours we have. That's all we have now. And it means that I don't want to lose any more time at the beginnings of our evenings or ends as necessary. I am planning then for your questions. And I thought that the questions had best be the last day, because I'm sure there are many things you will ask me that I'd like to bring in. For instance, I've been asked great many questions about philosophy, about God, what I feel about such matters, and I plan to do that the next to last day. In other words, I'm beginning to see exactly what we have available and what we've got to do with that time. And I'd like to also point out that I'm hoping that someday you'll all be interested enough in what we've experienced together to wish, for instance, to make models for your own, on your own experience. Because with the video as a medium, the video as a medium, it is possible, as with all tape, to come back at any point and actually run over that point and superimpose, takes out the old image and puts in the new. So we could keep the voice going and could put in a better picture of the model at various points as we see fit. If we're unhappy about what we have as a total result, I think it'll be primarily due to the feeling about models. We ourselves could, if we liked our product, could very greatly improve it by making models of those places that would be better than the picture we see there. Now I'm going to have some of the slides, please. And there are some that I'm going to do tonight that review fairly fast some of the things we've already been through the other night, but I think I saw on slides that seem to be a little better. Now, you remember dealing with our topology, and we had this inventory of relative numbers of vertexes, faces, and edges, that when we took out the two polar axial vertexes of every accounting, then we found that the relative abundance was such that for every vertex, there were always two faces, there were always three edges, which told us then, because everything is double, there's an inside and out, so there's a multiplicative two, there's six of the vectors. In this picture right now, we see on the tetrahedron, the left, there are three of the edges that have been shadowed. I wanted to try to follow those three increments. You see in the cube, three red ones and three black ones and three white ones. And there's one other color. They're always in threes. And we see in the octahedron, next picture, you make any of the other polyhedra were always just in threes. And those threes, remember, also were our friend action, reaction, and resultant. So that the vectors are always action, reaction, resultant, and they always come together to make some total structures. Next picture, please. Now, this is one that I mentioned something to you the other day when it came to the three-frequency vector equilibrium made out of spheres, which shows four to an edge, four balls to an edge, but it's three spaces. I also mentioned that in the square faces of the vector equilibrium where the outer shell was the number 92, there were, in each of the square faces, four spheres which could be loaned out of the system without in any way and hurting the structure, the integrity of the structure of the system. And I find then we do find atoms in combination, combining chemistry, where they're able to loan, one can loan up to four out to the other. And we see that those fourness in those square faces. Those square faces, you remember, were square half octahedron. We had them, they were the internal octahedra, where the two vector equilibria came face to face, and the octahedra was hidden in the two. So that would be where the four could be exchanged to do the bonding between them. The next picture, please. Now here I have, you see, it looks like a lot of circles. What I did was to take a metal floor in a subway where people all walking over it all the time, scratching. And there's a bright light. But anyway, you'll find if you look at any scratch surface, you'll always see circles. And you keep moving along, but there's a beautiful sound of circles every time. And it's very important to explain to yourself how all the randomness can disclose to you a set of circles, concentric circles. Well, it's fairly easy to realize that the shadows, as long as there's a light, the scratches actually have shadows. And like a mountain range, there's a dark side and there's a light side of the mountain range where the sun shines on it. And what happens here with the light present is that all the lines that are approximately at right angles or precessional to the light are the ones that get lit up. So you'll always find then the other ones don't get illuminated, so you always get then this beautiful sunburst. I find this a very important matter because it really shows how any kind of an event can find its own set of orders in a set of very great randomness. Next picture, please. Now we're looking at a sun shining on a spherical surface, very shiny one, and then also been scratched, polished a lot. And you see there a star pattern. Not only is there the circles, but it makes into the hexagon, breaks down into that. It sorts itself out in that, no matter where you look. Next picture, please. Here I was studying the action reaction. Several of the items in this picture are not there, but we have a man in a rowboat, and he jumps from one rowboat to another, making one shoot very fast. But you find that rowboat that he jumped out of, and the one he goes for, they both tended to really steer right around. They don't go off the. Next picture. And I'm trying to make that a little clearer, where he's now jumping from a boat to a little sloop and so forth, and you see the arrows down the bottom there indicate the way the thing happens. The barred line, the dobber pole part, is where he's doing the jumping, and the white is the boat that he had jumped from, and the red is the one he jumped onto. Next picture. And we have the same business here again, where he's jumping from one to the other, and the barber pole is the way he's doing the jumping, and the white is the one he jumped from, and the red is the one he jumped onto, and they come back, the triangle even comes back to itself. Next picture. So we find all these different ways in which the three vectors of action, reaction, resultant, which are always in every system, can come out. They can look like a Z, or they can come back and even look like a triangle. It's fun to make them look like a triangle. And you can take two triangles like this, and you say, "I have two triangles," and then you open them up and put them together, and you find they make the six edges of the tetrahedron. So suddenly you had two triangles you put in and come out with four triangles. In other words, there always is an invisible, it's like giving you the convex and concave, and the convex just has nothingness in it. Next picture. Now I'm going to look at two tetrahedra, and the white and the black tetrahedra, and I made this model out of very stout rod, and the white and black, and they are congruent, and they're springy rods, and so they're able to sort of twist in and out of one another. Next picture, I find that I had one that's locked into the other, so they can't get away, so they get to where they'd be just vertex to vertex like that. Next picture, then they can be rotated in such a way that one is inside the other, and makes a star called the eight-pointed star, which makes the cube. And it's a fascinating matter to find one of those tetrahedra can literally roll like as if it was a ball instead of a tetrahedron. The relationship of the edge to edge, no matter how you make it, they never get out of kilter. There are six edges always touching, there are six edges always touching six edges, and they're always in contact, and one never pushes a pull. They rotate around on each other superbly, either be congruent or in this position. Next picture. Here's another one of the rotated positions. Next picture. Then they can cross B face to face to tetra. And this, as remember, was the atom clock where they pump when the one vertex would pump through the base and come out the other side, back and forth, back and forth. Next picture. Now I'm going to do things, give you some information that I hope is going to help to understand and to cause and feel quite strongly the model of yesterday when we were, saw the spaces becoming the spheres and the spheres becoming the spaces, and the transformation from being vector equilibrium to octahedron and so forth. Now, here is a tetrahedron inside of a cube, giving the cube its shape. And I have also strung on the top of the cube a single string that goes from the far right corner back to the left, far left corner, and then back to itself. It's a circle, and it's strung over the pipes. And the edge of the tetrahedron is just lying between the paired circle of these two lines. And then we have a string, which you can't really see, at the middle of the top edge of the tetrahedron, and we're going to pull the tetrahedron out of the cube. Next picture. We're starting to lift the tetrahedron. It slides with its vertex followed beautifully, the edges, and we find the six edges keep sliding absolutely perfectly on the four square edges of the cube at the top. As we pull it up, that line which I said was went back and forth from left corner to right corner, it went under the thing, and back over the top, over the top. It now is a quadrangle, and as we're pulling the tetrahedron out, it gets spread. Next picture. Now the tetrahedron has been pulled a little further, and you can see the line which I said, this piece of rope that goes around, the quadrangle is opening up all the time. And all the time, all the parts of the tetrahedron are touching the cube very beautifully, sliding right out. Next picture. Now it's halfway out, and the piece of rope has become a square. And that square, incidentally, is what has a cross section of a tetrahedron. If you want to make it really, really good, you cut right here, and the cut right comes out here, and you find that is where the octahedron is inside, a section of the octahedron. And so, next picture, please. Now the tetrahedron being pulled a little further, and the quadrangle is now contracting from a square, but is now orienting from another corner. Next picture. It's oriented 90 degrees. This is one of those precessional things. It went from going this way to that way now. Next picture. Now I guess we're ready to be pulled out. Next picture. And the rope goes absolutely right straight across now. Next picture. And then the cube, take the tetrahedron out, and the cube collapses. It's a very beautiful model of this one, made for Institute of Design in Chicago long years ago. Next picture. Now, this picture, I'm sorry to say, does not show it very clearly, but you'll see a cube. There's three cubes, one above the other. And in that cube, you'll find that there is a position where a triangle inside the cube sits near the lower right-hand side. In the top picture, that triangle is in there. It's actually following position. Remember, I had a tetrahedron inside the cube, and it's taking one of the faces of that tetrahedron, going up like this, and so it's inside there, Now I rotate that triangle inside the cube, and it continually, it shuttles back and forth, goes to the left side. It's coming from the lower right up towards the upper left corner. I'm sorry that you can't see all those pictures, but it is a very beautiful thing. So we made the model. Next picture, we have a model where you can see the, I made just such a frame so you can literally see the triangle shuttle back and forth. Next picture. Here we made a steel cube. Could you block my head out? We have a steel cube, and it is made by in a general chassis, a frame, and that cube is made in two halves. Over, you can look at the right-hand side of your picture, the white cube, and you see going up in the middle of it here a groove, that the two halves. There's a groove that goes completely around it, zigzag, 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 six parts. And there is, the cube is mounted rigidly at two halves apart like that, and there's an axis, two journals in the end, and there's a handle that moves a rod running through the diagonal of the cube, which is horizontal in our picture. And mounted on it, near the left-hand side, you'll see a triangle, three struts coming out from the shaft to the triangle, and there is a point sticking of that triangle sticking out at the top of the cube right now. We rotate the handle of that shaft, and we find that the triangle's end, which is up through the top of the, moves down the far left side. Next picture. Can you see that moving down the far top side? Next picture. It is now moved clear down to the bottom. Next picture, and at the far side. Now it is starting to shuttle back again. Next picture. Now this business of the triangle pumping back and forth inside happens to be nothing more than what happens if you remember that you complete a vector equilibrium's eight corners by putting 1/4 octahedra on them. You get a cube. Do you remember that? Okay. That being so, then this could be a cube. And if it was so, this triangle would be in the corner of that cube. Now, what happens when I... Oh, the big cube represented by completing those corners, that consists of eight cubes. You can make a big cube out of eight little cubes, two cubes to the edge. I want you to assume that, so there'll be, for each of the eight triangles here, there'll be eight cubes. And this triangle in my hands is in the cube in this corner here. And when I pump this down to become the octahedron, it simply is shuttled from one side of the cube to the other. I found that there was a triangle in cubes doing very strange things, so that I wanted to really study what they were doing. I found by making these models, sure enough, the triangle can rotate in the cube, but what happens is I made my triangle a little smaller than the cube, so that and each corner of the triangle, and that steel model, the frame, we had a little steel pipe running out from each of the three vertexes of the triangle, out through the runner to be guided. And we found that as it goes through the cube, it literally goes, makes a circle, makes an arc. The end makes an arc. In other words, the end goes outwardly as it goes through and then back flush. And we made that model in such a way, those were all tubes, and we have made it so we could have lights. So that when you find that as you did the sea, on each of the eight triangles that can be in any cube, they'd all be pumping and they'd be going two ways on the edges of the cube with a little light. You can see a sphere, you see a spherical cube. and see it being defined by shuttling lights going both ways as a consequence of the pumpability of these triangles in them. All these things have to do with experiences we have. We try to explain all kinds of phenomena absolutely just as a inventorying of data, of energy. But I'm quite confident these relate to all the kinds of different kinds of other physical phenomena we do have. Next picture. But they do explain how and why, when the vector equilibrium became an octahedron, and the octahedron became a vector equilibrium, and each of the spheres became spaces, space became spheres. As they did so, each of the triangles bulged a little, so that inasmuch as every one of them bulged in the transformation, it made the whole system bulge uniformly, all directions, so it became a spherical bulge. And this was what brought about the visibility of the electromagnetic wave. Next picture, please. Now, you block me out, please. Here's something we had yesterday, the precessional effect of the two edges of the three ball edge tetrahedron or two frequency tetrahedron coming together precessionally. Next picture. I'm reviewing that quite rapidly because I want to get to some other things that I've added in. Next picture. Over and above what you had yesterday. They're the two halves of the three frequency. Next picture. They come together as a tetrahedron, precessionally again. Next picture. And we have then this is the 7/8 frequency, and they come together again as the next picture, as the tetrahedron. And next picture, again, we then have the 2/1/8 octahedra. And I'm sorry to say the top one is not clear, and they precess together to give us the cube. This is the first cube to appear in spheres. In other words, you can't have a sphere with 8 cubes, just corners at all. There are in this, and the base is 6 and the 7, so they're 14. So this first cube is apparently 14. It's very, very possibly something to do with carbon. It seems very logically so. Next picture. There we see the completion of the corners of the octahedron, of the vector equilibrium, by putting on the 1/8 octahedron in each corner. Next picture, and we take it off and we get the vector equilibrium itself. Next picture, and then we take this whole thing apart in its various slices. Next picture, please. I also then want to remind you of something I gave you the very first day. The vector equilibrium, remember those shells, you remember? First shell, 12, next shell, 42, next shell, 92, counting up to 146, the plus 92 gives us 238. I'd like to show you something about that I didn't mention that day. So we have the formula. For the numbers of balls in the outer layer was always, remember, frequency to the second power times 10 plus 2. Remember that? And I made that very clear why that was so. So we found then that we had this layer of 12 and 42, 92, and 162, so forth, 252. Then, however, this was the first layer that there was a ball inside. So it's zero layer. In other words, it can't be a layer, yes, to say, unless the ball itself really, there's a ball there, and it has an outside and an inside. And these layers have been closing, so I'll have to remember then, this was being frequent the second power times 10 plus 2, we then found that was 10, and we then took over. So this is 12 was, one was the number one, the first layer. This is number two. this is number three, number four. Those are the numbers that became second power. Okay? So the center ball is zero. So I find out, remember what the formula is. So it is frequency to second power times 10 to... So zero to the second power is zero. Times 10 is zero. Plus 2 is 2. The value of the second in the ball there, it turns out always to be 2. Otherwise, its own concave, its own convex. And I've given you unity is 2, and you find it showing up time and again when it comes to this extreme. So I find it a very, very exciting point, and I hadn't given it to you the first day, and it was very important to come in today. Next picture, please. Here we have the knocking the central ball out, you remember, and from the vector equilibrium, and immediately became the icosahedron. Same 12 balls, it's simply the squares disappeared and they became triangulated, as the pumping model shows very, very clearly. Just make a quick review of it. We went from open vector equilibrium down to here, then we add these in here, and here's icosahedron. That's icosahedron. So it's like everything else, a degree of contraction. Everything that happens in vector equilibrium where the realities begin to occur, there's always some degree of contraction. So this is a much further degree of contraction, even further so when it came down to the tetrahedron. Incidentally, there's another tetrahedron in the vector, in the jitterbug, which I haven't tried to make for you before. And this is a polarized one. See the precessional edges, like my left hand and right hand, I have the double edges, all the rest are single. All these things occur without ever breaking the edge. Otherwise, the integrity of the system is always there. Next picture, please. On the left, you'll see, these are pictures from Linus Pauling's paper, Linus Pauling's book. And you see a column there of the polarized column. And he has the same picture I showed you, taking off one whole large corner of that cube. Next picture. I'm sorry, there's something else over on the other side that's very interesting. I made, in the late 30s and early 40s, I was able to get a hold of beautiful little clear crystal balls, and I found it was transparent, gluing them together. I was able to make very fine models. I think we still have them, but they began to tell me, this upper row here, I began to really get faithfulness in respect to various atoms, and this all was part of what kept me going. You can imagine when I first began to discover all these rational relationships, and I was able really to talk about them in the 30s, and I began to confront scientists with when I was fighting, and they found no identity with what they were thinking, and they were not thinking models, and they felt any attempt to bring the models in was really tending to really roll backwards into the Platonic era, and this is all nonsense. What I would have to say to myself, I would ask the scientist if he could find anything wrong with my arithmetic or my geometry. They say no. I found this beautiful hierarchy of rational values, and I'd say, do you think I ought to go on? And he'd say, yeah, I think you seem to have logic in it, all right, you might as well pursue it, but it doesn't have any significance in physics. It's just sort of a mathematical pastime. And so I finally had to ask myself a good question. I said, am I so important that the universe would secrete a great cul-de-sac of incredible beauty and elegance just to fool me? I said, I'm just not that important. So I have to assume it's really very important and other people are wrong. This had to be my argument, and I've carried that on in a really very long time. Next picture. On the left, we then see our friend the tetrahedron with the octahedron in the center. I didn't have a nice model like that to show you the first day, so I thought I'd show that again. Next picture, please. Something's gone wrong on my picture. That was going back. This is a picture of great importance because we're looking at the skeletonized tetrahedron with the octahedron inside it. And on the left-hand side, lower left-hand side, you see a blackened tetrahedron. Its base is on the table. And immediately to the right of its base is then a base of an asymmetrical tetrahedron. It has the same triangular base, both equilateral, but you see a dotted line going from the lower mid-right side of the big tetrahedron, there's a dotted line going to the top of the small tetrahedron in the left-hand corner. And that is then the one of the XYZ coordinates running, because the octahedron then has three corners, and this one of the other. And that edge then makes an asymmetrical tetrahedron that's leaning to the leaning leftwards and leaning tower of Pisa, but has exactly the same size base as the tetrahedron, the regular tetrahedron on the outside. So you the bases are congruent. So we know they're the same. The vertexes, the top vertexes, apexes are congruent, and the bases are the same area, so their volumes must be the same. And that is a one-quarter octahedron. You see, it is just exactly one quadrant of the octahedron. You study it carefully. So you really feel very comfortable when I give you the octahedron as a volume of four and the tetrahedron as a volume, when the tetrahedron is volume one. Next picture. I didn't have the opportunity to show that to you. I talked about it, but no model. I'm just confirming to you from the other day the count of the tetrahedron England instead of cubing. When instead of superscript 3, we call this then tetrahedroning instead of cubing. And there is a count for each of those layers. The one, then the two get up to 8, 27, 64 as they combine. So you now feel quite content to. We have also found that the structure is triangle, and if it isn't triangulated, it's not a structure, it's unstable. And the tetrahedron was then the simplest structural, prime structural system of universe. And so when you count in tetrahedron and cube take 3, we're being more economical. And if you use a cube, you use 3 times more space, as nature's using, because she's always most economical. So if you want to catch on what she's doing most economical, you've got to use the tetrahedron. Next picture. Again, we really can't see. There's a vector equilibrium to the right, and it shows the one-eighth octahedron. No, the 8 tetrahedron go in, and the 6 one-half. Next picture. And that's showing a completion of one of the corners of the vector equilibrium to make it the cube by 1/8 octahedron. Next picture. This now is very, very important. We haven't come to this. Yes, we did in the terms of spheres in packing. Let me remind you again, when we're talking spheres in packing, we're talking about vertices. And when we're talking about edges, we're talking about, when we see lines and structures, we're talking about the edges. The counts are very different. There's one vertex, there's two areas, and three edges. So you see different. We're now looking at a skeletonized tetrahedron, and the center of gravity of the tetrahedron. And we pulled out from the center of gravity of the tetrahedron a one-quarter tetrahedron. And that one-quarter tetrahedron, you may remember, was formed by, we had a triangle of closely packed spheres, and its edge read 5, edge read 4, and there's one ball on top. It was a 3 frequency. There was then nestability. You remember that? Found that when you had 3 balls, there was no space. There's no, at a 2 ball, not only had the 3 frequency or 4 balls, did we have them? No. That gave us a ball in the center. It had to be 5 balls of 4 frequency before we get the tetrahedron, and the one-quarter tetrahedron. And this then was in the hierarchy of nestabilities. In other words, it wasn't a just being arbitrary and saying we're going to have one-quarter tetrahedrons and 1/8 octahedron. We found that those occurred where a ball can nest, and they were the sequence of the first time, the second time a ball can nest on top. You first nest the top to make a tetrahedron. Next time, it made a 1/8 octahedron. The third time, it made a 1/4 tetrahedron. Next picture. Now, those 1/4 tetrahedra up at the top, I've taken the octahedron and, that's all right. On each of its 8 faces, we put a 1/4 tetrahedron. Again, it's regular equilateral triangles, all the same vector edge, so they fit perfectly well. I got one here, and then another one here. And when you do, you'll find that the apex of those 1/4 tetrahedra are in the same plane as that line between the two. And what it does is to form the rhombic dodecahedron. It's a fascinating thing. each one, as they come up here, this makes sense for each of the 12, there are 12 edges on the octahedron. And the apex would come up here, and it becomes a flat, it makes a diamond. It makes a diamond on each edge of the octahedron. There are 12 edges, so you get 12 diamond faces, and there's your rhombic dodecahedron. A rhombic dodecahedron is a very exciting kind of a form. Its volume is exactly 6 when the tetrahedron is 1, and the octahedron, its cube is 3, and the octahedron is 4, and so forth. 6. And sixness what is this rhombic dodecahedron? Remember, the vector equilibrium has 12 vertexes. And those 12 vertexes of the vector equilibrium are where every sphere in closest packing is contact to the next sphere. Now, there also were the spaces and the spheres in closest packing. And what the rhombic dodecahedron does, each one of those diamond faces occurs at the point of tangency, that there are 12 of those diamond faces, and each one at the center of it is where each sphere touches the other sphere. So what the rhombic dodecahedron, like the cube, fills all space. So what it is both the sphere and the space. It goes in exactly, and there's an octahedron space and a vector equilibrium space, and it exactly goes to the center of gravity of that space. So it represents the volume of the sphere and the volume of the space that belongs to that sphere. And there it is, the volume is 6. It's a beautiful rational number. Now, we're going to see a lot more about this rhombic dodecahedron because it is then really the epitome of the behavior of the spheres in closest packing, and it is, I would simply call it, the domain of a sphere, and sometimes I call it a spheric, because it is the domain of the sphere. It's a sphere and the sphere's own share of space. And that is not a 20 like the vector equilibrium, nor a 4 like the octahedron. It's a very, very important number. 6 is a spheric space, a domain. And we've been dealing with spheres in a way we sort of used to think about spheres and so much of the pi business. Although somehow there's some very nice numbers coming in here without so far getting into any calculation of that kind whatsoever. Next picture, please. Now I have a very strange cutting here where we take the vector equilibrium and we take the 1/8 octahedron that we put onto each of the triangular faces there to make it into a cube. Then you remember that the vector equilibrium has, as a sphere, it had 25 great circles, remember that? And remember those 25 great circles, there was 3 great circles, 4 great circles, that's 7. There was 6 great circles, make 13, and 12 great circles, make total 25. If we had each one of those great circle planes were extended and into the cube, and it would, so I had those planes then come out, I've got this corner on here, and they cut in, they cut, get outside the vector equilibrium, and they cut up this little corner into pieces. Next picture, go back to the picture, may I see that picture again? So what you see there on the left, all on the right, lower right, is the 1/8 octahedron corner. And you can see the lines on the surface of it, and it's been cut up internally by all the 25 great circles. Now, back in 1947, I did put my trigonometry carefully, and I found what the volumes were, and they all come out rational number. But these little fractions are coming out rational. boy, you better work harder still. And I just like to have that mentioned. Next picture. Now here is a looking at a vector equilibrium cut through the center, and we'll see a central vector equilibrium and 1, 2, 3, there are 4 enclosures. I found that whereas I gave you for each layer in terms of spheres, there were 12, 42, 92, and so forth. I found that the volumes were growing. The volume of the vector equilibrium is 20, and the sum total volume of the vector equilibrium is always frequency to the third power times 20. For instance, if the frequency were 20, then the volume would be 3 to the fourth power. We do not start with a zero, we start with entity. 20 is unity. Unity can never be less in vector equilibrium. Unity is 20. In the octahedron, unity is 4. It never is less. That's where the number begins. So that when we found that the rate at which layers grew of the vector equilibrium, I gave you the series of layers. If I took where the outer set of balls were occurring, between that ball and the next layer in it, there would be a plane to be struck. And that for any two layers, they combined to give me a very interesting number where the volumes were growing as frequency to the second power times 6 plus 2. In other words, there's something to do with this spheric space. This number 6 being very unique to the rhombic dodeca or the domain of the sphere. So those spaces that you're looking at there now, pairing any two will always be frequency to the second power times 6 plus 2. Next picture. What I'm looking at here, this lower right-hand cone, is quite difficult to see. You're looking at the icosahedron, you've got the perpendicular bisectors of it. In other words, we're looking at the 15 great circles that give you 120 spaces, 120 right triangles on the surface of the sphere, which I said the Babylonians identified as very important. If I can have the picture back again, I found then that inasmuch as the octahedron has 8 faces, and there were 120 triangular faces showing there, I said, can you divide 120 by 8? And I found you could. It's 15. And I said, it could be that if I took the icosahedron's face and added around each of the 3 edges, I would add, because I know there's 6 inside, the 6 triangles inside the icosahedron's face. So 6 from 15 leaves me 9. There are 3 edges. Therefore, if I could find a way of mounting 3 triangles on each edge of the icosahedron's triangle in such a symmetrical way where they would make a corner of 90 degrees, like the octahedron, then I might find an octahedron inside the icosahedron. And sure enough, we do have it. In the lower right-hand side, you'll then see the octahedron in the icosahedron, they skew like this. We have tomorrow I'll bring a model here where you'll see the icosahedron inside the octahedron, and you'll find that it literally is rotatable. Will you bring that, Maddie, from the office tomorrow? Next picture. Now, remember, I'm looking at a. Again, I'm not seeing enough. I'm going to go to the board to show you your squares and triangles and your counts were all super clear. But we have the 2 triangles and a square. But I want to show you something about primes and squares, which then also applies to rectilinears. That model is here? Oh, how beautiful. We will not go any further without you recognize your yellow octahedron now and your red icosahedron. And notice that it is Q in there, the points like that. And I'm going to do this. It wrote right in there. Fantastic. The beauty of these two coming together. So I want to get into really the rationality of the interrelationship of this icosahedron, which is always bothering you because its volume is 18.51, and so all the others are rational, and you have to realize it's a very special behavior, that icosahedron, because it can only have one layer of the balls and close it back and do the contraction. No room for the second layer. The vector equilibrium position, there is room for the layers, but then it's contracted, only room for that. The outer layer can be triangulated, yeah, no more layers. It is inherently a single layer affair. So again, it makes me feel it's very much an electron behavior, and I have to note these kind of reciprocities. Now, I was going to come over to talking about, if I make any quadrangular form, but not equal edges. If I bisect those edges and interconnect, I do not get four similar forms. Not so. If I take any triangle, I bisect its edges, and then I get four exactly similar triangles. That is, the triangle is inviolable in the matter of its, it can look like anything to you in this universe, but always, the countings that I've been giving you always come out exactly the same, whether it looks like a regular tetrahedron or not. And the same thing, if I made that a rectilinear thing, it'd be a whole lot of trouble, as you know. The tetrahedron can look like anything you want, and it still comes out this way. Now, there were two forms that showed in the last pictures where I saw they were not clear enough to really bring to your attention, but I'm now going to get into an accounting, just doing this for you myself. I'm going to make I've got a tetrahedron made of rubber. I've got rubber bands coming from me. And I'm going to hold the base of my tetrahedron between my 2 feet. This is a basic one. And you can take a hold of the vertex over there. And I'm going to make a line parallel to my feet here. And I'm going to hold this tetrahedron top here. As long as you just move this line always parallel to me, the area of the triangle it forms at the base here will be the same base and same altitude, because the lines are parallel to one another. Agree? So then I find that I can move that base line, and I can also then move my top here in a plane parallel to the floor. So I find that out of the tetrahedrons, four corners, I hold two of them. I hold one edge fixed only, and the other five edges are continually changing, but it always remains the same size tetrahedron. So I could move this vertex way, way over there, and move that one on the floor over there. Always the same altitude, same base. Otherwise, you could get to an extraordinary asymmetric looking tetrahedron here, but it always holds true. And I'm quite confident this has a whole lot to do with the fundamentals of tunings. I said I could subdivide those triangles any way I want. Doesn't make a difference at all. It all comes out always the same value. I think it's a whole lot to do with with electromagnetic tuning, where you can tune in here and I can tune any place in the universe, we simply come in. I haven't made that particularly clear, that point, but as time goes on, I'll clarify. Next picture, please. The first day I tried to have a stick standing up here and didn't work. So I had a picture over here, but it doesn't really do much better. I've got two sticks standing on the lower left-hand side, and they can swab anywhere, but then over the right, they fall towards each other. And so they engage these other tops, so now they can act as a hinge. Next picture. And here we have the three of them falling towards each other and making a tetrahedron. But its legs can go out, so we have to have a set of tensions down there. Next picture. That's part of what I've been talking about. Next picture, please, about the distortions. Here you have a drawing I was making of tetrahedra. These very simple things where they get very narrow, get to be like the tree. So I gave you the other day a tree, as we know, the cambium layer. Each year the cambium layer encloses the next one. And we find they literally do grow. The top is narrow and they are tetrahedron. Some, they might look more like a cone to start off with, but no. You find the roots that they do the stresses tend to go out tetrahedrally. So that I said each layer of the cambium layer, the trees continue one tetrahedron enclosing another, and the branches themselves go out as tetrahedra. And you find the wing root is really exactly that. The bottom of the wing root in here is deep and it's flat, goes out. That's the shape of the wing root. So each branch is a tetrahedron. And it gets its cambium layers, and each twig is the same. They continue this way with tetrahedron, embracing tetrahedron. And so the body and the whole thing goes out of it. Now, I was just making pictures here of tetrahedra, and I had them perpendicular to the Earth. There's an Earth surface with upside down the bottom. That's all right. There's no upside down universe, so it's valid. I had been making that picture when next day somebody gave me picture of Radio Laria. Next picture. And these are Radio Laria, and look just like my sketching, so much so I thought I'd like to just show these two coming together. Next picture, please. Here I have three ships. I was in the Navy, and I've been taught about Galileo's parallelogram of forces. And I've been taught that the way you make a parallelogram of force, you have two masses moving such a velocity in such a direction. So you make the vectors that length, respectively. Then you make two lines parallel to them, making a parallelogram. Then they had you make a diagonal of the parallelogram to the point of impact. And then extend that diagonal outwardly right through the point, equal length to its diagonality, and it would be the result of the forces. Well, when I got Navy, I began to feel this was very nonsense, because I said when two ships run into each other, they don't go waltzing north-northeast for 12 miles or whatever. One goes to the bottom, and that wasn't in the diagram, and I think you got to have a little different kind of a diagram. So I found that both ships were in great acceleration. And the fact is, when they do hit, they rise because the resultant is outwardly at the Earth. They're both in acceleration, they're trying. So the total resultant is going to primarily upwardly like that, and then one goes down and one rolls away over that side there, and one goes to the bottom. I found it really made the music stand for them and really made them, I found the tetrahedron again. Under the three legs and the vertical of the tetrahedron. Next picture. While we're looking at such forms, I thought it'd be interesting to look at the... May I have that back, please? This is the looking in a cloud chamber. And I spoke to you the other day about two lines can't go through the same point at the same time. And this was when they bombard, with the neutron bombarding a whole lot of atoms, This is a typical kind of the picture, the cloud chamber picture. You see these resultant angles of the bombardment. Next picture. And put all the light you can in on this, please. I spoke to you the other day about going to the island of Crete, because I could read this picture well today. I took photographs in the great palace of Gnosis, and on the wall there you'll see a hexagon. This is what is called the king's sign. And why they call it the double axe, I don't know, because I think that's a really very foolish kind of way to talk about it. Quite clearly, here's the hexagon. Next picture, please. And blot me out, and let's just have these pictures. Here we. This is another one. It's a little cocked, though. Next picture. And there you see the distaff side, the English flag with the vertical cross and the diagonal cross. That's the distaff side. I just want you to see these things that are on that wall, and I spoke to you about them, the possibility that this great invasion of breaking down of Crete, which has been the stronghold of the water people, was broken down by lesser water people who were more landed, and the Ionians coming out, and suddenly the mathematics breaks into the open, but it breaks open on the distaff side with the XYZ coordinates rather than the 60 degrees, which I think remained very, very secret to the navigator and calculator. Next picture. Here I've taken two of the DNA, RNA, just tetrahelix, three of them. And you'll find that as you make one of these, it you make it spiral positive, you make it spiral negative. But you find that if you make them all positive, then they will nest in one another. But if the one's positive, one negative, they do not nest. They have to be, and this is when you're twisting rope, they'll have both either positive and negative twist to settle one into the other. Now, one of the things that have been very fascinating to the Watson, Crick, Wilkerson, and all the people who studied along with them, all the virologists trying to understand what's going on here, is that the design that is codified and controlled by the DNA RNA, we find that the child unzips from the mother as the prototype form. It becomes part like that. So it had a lot to do with trying to put these things together and see how they were nesting to one another and why they might let go. Now, because I also do my trigonometry in extreme depth to be sure that I really have my figures very close on, I'm really quite familiar with the form that the chemist or the virologist making a model like this simply finds, as he did, that he had 36 degree increments to each, because he found with the helix. And so 10 times that was 360 degrees, so it seemed to be a cycle. I found it really was not exactly so, because you take the tetrahedron, it's like cut a plane perpendicularly against this line through here, that this angle here is 70 degrees and 32 minutes. And the octahedron, when we balance, and one sits in it. So this angle is 110 degrees, 109 degrees and 28 minutes, 70, 32. They're absolutely discrete. So I found that there was a very interesting set of information coming in, where when great shear, great plates of steel are sheared, and great testing of Navy work and so forth, that they always tend to shear at an angle which the metallurgist has been calling 70 and 70 and 110, which add up to 180. And so too have the faults, the earthquake faults and so forth, the earth faults continually showing up in the 70 and 110. I said, I'm sure they're not 70 and 110, they're 109 degrees and 38 minutes and 70 degrees and 32 minutes. But it makes a great deal of difference when you make sharp accounting. And I found then that when you make the tetrahelix, the tetrahelix coming around because there's accumulation then of the dihedral angles to come to the top. And lots of people take the tetrahedra and try to put them together edge to edge like this. And you seem to be able to get, if you're just doing it with things like this, you say, I'm getting five around one. But you find this little opening there. And it's always there. So we find out exactly what that opening is. You take 5 times 70, 32. 252, 40. So we take 360 degrees minus 352, 40. 7 degrees and 20 minutes. This is the difference. So that when we get in that tetrahelix going up like that, we find that the 70 degrees and 32 minutes is in there, and yet there's enough torque in my models when I make this long thing so that you can pull them together. Otherwise, in the twistability, you can get one to wind in tight enough to throw the hole. But they want them to spring. Now, one thing that I couldn't quite understand what they were looking that the child wants is, tends to unzip from his mother. So here's the unzippability suddenly there. I was able to explain this to the Watson Crick Wilkerson group, and that has found considerable favor with biologists, and that's probably so. But their model looks so strange that they don't think about it as being tetrahedral. I find human beings just not tending to think that. If you really get the kind of experience you're having with me, you're going to have to always think tetrahedrally, and you realize that really all helixes are really brought about. There are many ways in which you make them by taking the strange matchboxes and other tricks and putting them together. It always comes out following the same rules and laws. Next picture, please. This is simply a picture of the when I gave you the hammer thrower and the showing precession and why the wheel tilted the way it did. This is part of my, if anybody of you would like to, you can go back and look at May 1940 Fortune magazine and you'll find my explanation of a double spread page of the gyro, which the Sparrow Company said was absolutely faithful and they didn't think it would be done, but it was done. Next picture. Now I'm just looking at a large tetrahedron and inside of it and the octahedron and so forth. Next picture. I want you to think at a big tetrahedron now in which something else is going on. There's a center of gravity, there's a center of the base triangle. You can see that. Now, above it, there's a point, and that is the center of gravity of the tetrahedron. That's where the one-quarter tetrahedron comes into it. And above it, an equal increment there is a vertex of the one-eighth octahedron, which is superimposed. Can you get me out of the picture, like every bit we can of what we're looking at there? There is then a tetrahedron, and it encloses with the same common base a one-eighth octahedron, and enclosed within it is a one-quarter tetrahedron. Now, a one-eighth octahedron has a volume of two, remember? The octahedron has a volume of four, so one-eighth turned out to be two. And the one-quarter tetrahedron, then, it has a volume of one, of a, where the one-eighth octahedron is two, and the tetrahedron itself in this case, I'm going to make it volume of four. If the volume of the tetrahedron is four, the one-eighth octahedron will have a volume of two. It has the same base as the big tetrahedron, but half the altitude. And the one-quarter tetrahedron has one-quarter the altitude and the same base. So if the big tetrahedron is four, the small tetrahedron is two, and the and the bottom one is one. And as the volume of the 1/8 octahedron turns out to be exactly twice the volume of the 1/4 tetrahedron. 1/8 octahedron is twice that of the 1/4 tetrahedron. Next picture, please. We're going to have some very interesting things showing up here. Now, I've got four black 1/4 tetrahedra coming out of the big tetrahedron. Next picture. Now, there's a one regular 1/4 tetrahedron. As you know, the regular equilateral triangle has three perpendicular bisectors. I'm taking a plane perpendicular to the base plane, three such planes, and chopping, they come down to the perpendicular bisectors, and they cut the 1/4 tetrahedron into six parts. Remember, if I stepped tetrahedrons up to have a volume of four for the convenience, and we made then the 1/8 octahedron volume of two, and we made the 1/4 tetrahedron volume of one. I've now chopped these all up into units so that each one will be 1/6 of one. For a moment, I'm going to multiply everything now. So this, each one of these blacks will be 1/24 of a tetrahedron. There are four faces, and it breaks into six parts. There's 1/24 of a tetrahedron. So I call that unity, then the tetrahedron has 24, and all the other numbers multiply the same way. Next picture. That 1/24 of the tetrahedron is a very interesting thing, because you can make it out of one triangle. I have the dimensions of that. It's not a right triangle, but it is a triangle. And so you can fold it up out of one triangle. When you fold a tetrahedron out of one triangle into a tetrahedron, then it has very interesting. For instance, you can take an equilateral triangle, bisect its edges, interconnect, you get four triangles, and then you fold on those truncated corners, and you get. So when you do, energies that would bounce around inside of a triangle and keep bouncing around inside of the tetrahedron. So this is an asymmetrical tetrahedron that's folded out of all one triangle. Therefore, it is an energy inhibitor. It'll hold energy bouncing around inside of it. Next picture, please. Now, move my head out. You'll see the 1/4 tetrahedron, and there are on the sides there. Excuse me. We've not done this here properly, so that I'm going to ask you to go back if you remember that black skeleton where I had a tetrahedron and under the 1/8 octahedron, under it the 1/4 tetrahedron. And there were a whole lot of little lines there. I not only took this vertical plane of cleavage of the perpendicular bisectors of the 1/4 tetrahedron, but also of the 1/8 octahedron. So it too broke into six parts. But because the 1/8 octahedron had a volume of two, and the tetrahedron had a 1/4 tetrahedron volume of one, when I took one away from the other, one is under the other, then what the difference, the space between the 1/4 tetrahedron and the 1/8 octahedron is also one, because its total volume is two, and the thing it imposes is one, so the space between them is one. So when I then have these vertical planes cutting both the one superposed on the other, the perpendicular bisectors of the base triangle, each one breaks into six, and the six ones next picture I'm going to have, the top ones will be gray and the bottom is going to be black. That's what you're seeing there on the lower left hand side, are the gray ones which lay on top of the black ones, and they will fold in on top of it and next picture. There they are. The grays are on top of the blacks. You can see them there in the lower left-hand corner. And each one, the gray is exactly the same volume as the black one. In other words, the space between the one quarter tetrahedron and the one eighth octahedron was equal to one, the total volume being two, which was the volume of the one quarter eighth octahedron. So I found then if I'm going to call then the black 1/24, I'm going to also then let them be unity. So it should make the tetrahedron have to be 24. And then we find that each black and each gray there and each black have a volume of one. So what you're looking at is a set of six sitting on top of six. There's a volume of 12 involved in what you're looking at there. These are very asymmetrical. These are what I have here on the table. Here is there's the one sixth of a quarter tetrahedron. I call that an A, and here is the sixth of the 1/8 octahedron sitting on top of it, and it's a B. They're obviously very different shapes. And we call this the A quantum module and the B quantum module because, remember, then octahedron and tetrahedron do fill all space. And when we make them up, both A and we get something common to tetrahedron and octahedron, we suddenly can make all the geometries. And the A quanta and B quanta, these two alone, complement one another to make all the geometries. So they've got to be very, very, very important. This is one of the most important of all the discoveries I ever made. I think I'd like to just pass that to you to hand around. You've got to get a little feeling of it. And now the next picture, there you see two 1/4 tetrahedra fractionated, which equals 1/8 octahedron. Next picture. Now I'm making a large, you're doubling the size of a 1/8 octahedron. On the lower right-hand side, you'll see a 1/8 octahedron. And I put three of those on the corners of the thing on the left to make I'm doubling the size of the 1/8 octahedron. And you see then, there's that 1/8 octahedron in each corner, and then there's that one sitting on top of it there. You see six 1/8 octahedra there. But you remove those three top ones. Next picture. And you find that you have the, what was inside there was a tetrahedron. Now, this is 1/4 tetrahedron doubled in size. And in order to make it, you'd have to take, you have three regular 1/4 tetrahedra on the corners. And then inside them, you start piling the blacks, remember now, are the A's. So you have A, and the B. AAB. But I found that space, which they are, notice you've got a three-pointed star, haven't you? Of grayness. I'm going to be able to take those A's and B's out of that space and rearrange them so they don't look like that at all, but they still fill the same space. In other words, they're reorientable within the same space. Next picture. Now, they're the same ones, but their narrow ends are in, and they're not that way at all, poor. To find them, they're all radiant from the center. Do you notice? Can you go back one picture? This one where they're radiant from the mid-edge, inwardly. Their butt ends, they're putting their energies inwardly. The next picture, now they're radiant from the center out. They're radiant in the same phenomena, same A to B, rearrangeable in space, bring about completely different energy conditions. This began to really, really get me. And you realize if you took the center of gravity of each of those A and B's, the center of gravity is deployed in this picture. The first one there, they're concerned. I don't know if you've ever seen X-ray diffraction, where you hit metals and so forth, you really can see these displacements taking place. But it's one of those. Now, I'm going to talk some more about these A's and B's. They are very, very fascinating. I found then what I was putting together was this group right here. And they can be put together two ways. Here's an A and an A, but the B has been put in. In this hand, I've got an A and an A, base to base, and the B is out here. You can put them that way, but the point is, when you then turn like this, you find that they are, this is isosceles. They're isosceles in a number of different directions. This is an isosceles triangle. So that they're rotatable. They're right angle, a right angle, a right angle. Three sets of right angles in the inside here, which allow changing the right angles around, because that's an octahedral center. Realize how rotatable that is. And they're all these isosceles forms, so that they can really be changed around. Now, next thing about those A's and B's, you can go on and make all, I've made all the geometries there are, but when I handed those to you, if you look at them carefully, you'll see that they're also a little line, a curved line in there, as they come together here. Would you come take this one and pass it around? This is then, this point is the center of the spheres in closest packing, and these are a sphere in closest packing. You'll see how much of the, some of them, part of them occur in the space, and part of them are inside the spheres. And so as they keep coming together, they continually put spheres together. Now, the next thing I discovered, which was really, I told you then, this fills all space, the rhombic dodeca. And its face, its mid-face, is at the point of tangency between the adjacent spheres in closest packing. And then I found this extraordinary thing, that I can make this into an octahedron. So all those different 90 degrees, I can rotate these pieces around in an incredible number of ways. And this thing fits down into the rhombic dodecahedron here. So this is what I call the coupler between any two spheres. It is also all space filling, just as rhombic dodecahedron. But you see the two spheres kissing one another in here. So its volume consists now of each one of those is 1/24th of a tetrahedron. And there are obviously 2, 3, 6, 12, there are 24 of them, which is the same as one tetrahedron, isn't it? But there are 24 of them. So it is back to our friend unity, like the tetrahedron. And I call this thing the coupler. And I find then what it does, now you're going to see a series of pictures where you can rotate, you make these in different colors, the A's and B's, to see what you're getting. But the numbers of rotations in place within the coupler have seemed to be very close to the same number as the periodic table of the atoms, looks like it's 92, rearrangements within it. Next picture, please. I'm just going to say to show you the fast. I have a little feeling. Oh, there you're looking at the octahedron. One half of the octahedron is broken up into the A's and B's, the top half. Next picture. At the right upper right hand end is an A, and the white is a B. The only difference between these is another unit of altitude with the same base. As long as you have the same same base and increase one unit of altitude, and each is always the same fraction. So the orange then is another one unit more of altitude, and the black is the top of the tetrahedron. Then goes another one and another one. Always the same increment, therefore the volumes are always the same. They get thinner and thinner and thinner. We find then energies that are putting on a conductor like this really tend to keep going, the waves going outwardly now, it gets flatter and flatter, getting more and more parallel to the conductor itself and trying to precess off of it. That's one of the problems with conductors. I want you to understand how really a wave, so this can act as an energy input, each one of those, a wave going on a conductor system. So you don't have to get very much altitude then, they seem to be absolutely parallel. Next picture, please. I'm just showing A's and B's a little closer here. Next picture. And there we're seeing, I put together, I handed to you just a minute ago, three of them. And this is a negative, maybe. Because really, one's a positive, one's a negative, which way I do it. You can fill all space with a negative one. These are very extraordinary tetra, because you remember, regular tetrahedron can't fill all space. But this one can fill all space. Or the positive one, or they can do it together. And I call this, there are two ways of putting the six together, positive and negative. They can go this really long way, and the two ways they can go together. I call these the sight. The little one is the might, and these are the sights. And you see that in the two different arrangements. And they fill all space. So here, if we're using a quadrant as unity, where tetrahedron now must be 24, and octahedron is 4 times 24, and 72, so forth. But then find that these have a volume, they have a basic unit of six quanta. It's very interesting, that six quanta, because we found that there were six quanta. And when we talked about the basic, putting the proton and the neutron coming, around the two models, and we got the sixness, so basic six quanta. There's six quanta in there, and they will fill all the space, both positive and negative. So they do all the tricks you can possibly do. Next picture, please. These pictures that go on making sights and mice. So next picture. Next picture, please. Next picture. This was part of the rhombic dodecahedron. I found it I could open it and fold it, putting tapes to the edge, and it all fold together again. Next picture. There's the coupler. Next picture. Now, that's the way you can make either positive or a negative. You must start with two A's, and then either be on the right side or be on the left side. Next picture. And I've identified then where the rhombic dodeca is. You can see on each vertex of the vector equilibrium, and then where the coupler occurs. Next picture. Now, going to be a series of these. Next picture, where you see your spheres in the center. Next picture. Next picture. Not very sharp. Next picture. It's beginning to show you some of the strange combinations that begin to occur with the reds and blues. In some places they're conducting, sometimes they're not conducting, sometimes they're fortifying, sometimes subtracting, so forth. Next picture. Next picture. I'm going to just keep right on, will you? Just a little flick, because there are a whole series of them. Next picture. I made a series of all the possible combinations. These are all in the Synergetics book. Next picture. And there's an analysis of each one, how the energy values are, what it does, where shunting, blocking, conducting, and not conducting. Next picture. Just keep it on, please. I'd like to go through the series quite rapidly. You can just do it at will. The quicker you do it, the more rhythm you get out of it. Now, I'm going just quickly, that's the end of the A's and B's, but into some studies of the complexes of the octahedron and tetrahedron, which were made. Next picture. If you look at the complex, a vector equilibrium made of octahedron and tetrahedron, this is a two frequency. You find that there are very different aspects of them. You're going to see five different aspects. Next picture. You see through it in quite different ways. Next picture. Next picture. Keep right on. Next. Now, keep on. Next picture, please. Just getting into when I began to find the great strength you get of such trusses. It was just in North Carolina State back in the early 50s. And we found that they make very, very, very powerful structures. And next picture. Then we begin to get into fascinating mathematics. If you remove my head from the picture, these are octahedron, tetrahedron, complex trusses made out of single sheets of paper, strips of paper that you find that you can triangulate, and they seem to come coming together. Next picture. Next picture. This ones are done with a single set of wires, and so you make like bed springs and so forth. The wires can go making them. Next picture. Next picture again. That's Linus Pauling. These are out Linus Pauling's book. Next picture. We see the chemists paying great attention to these things. Next picture. Next picture. Now we're coming back to joints of the octahedron tetrahedron trusses. Since the rhombic dodeca occurs, we found that where the radii come together, these are then the perpendiculars to where all those lines that come in. This then becomes a very natural joint for it. And so you'll find a number of studies of that going on here. Next picture. There is a, this thing comes apart in one, two, these four parts. And may I have the picture back, please? And you can see it open like that, where the face is and the perpendicular is coming in. Next picture. And here's one with clevises, and you find that all these things can be brought together. Next picture. And it was along these lines that made the press. This is the beginning of my studies for what came to Ford Motor Company. Next picture. Where we made our struts out of sheet aluminum, just angled. And we found that the angles could overlap, around the vector equilibrium 12 vertexes, there's a turbining. I've shown you where our balls can get to two layers, begin to turbine. So there's literally these surfaces turbine around one on top of the other. So it was possible to have them overlap and just turbine on one another. Next picture.
The last one.
All in the coupler that I is an octahedron, those asymmetrical octahedron. And being an octahedron has really very interesting properties of octahedron. The mathematical properties. You're used to the XYZ coordinates and then to the fact that if you get into cartography and so forth, you'd find that the latitude, longitude, grids, anything that happens in one octant of the XYZ coordinates, it tells all the mathematical stories, things upside down, reverse, and so forth, but they go positive and negative. But so all the numbers, all the number relationships are all covered by your octant. I find this of great importance because I'd like to really know why that is. Can I give any kind of a mathematical, geometrical proof of why that would be so? I find it really quite interesting because, as you and I know, then the tetrahedron is then the minimum system dividing universe into insiders and outsiders, minimum structural system, and it is then has its four sides. So that there really are only total system really only requires four facets to tell the whole story. And I'm going to then look at an octahedron where we'll have this is a solid sheet. Then find that this is a solid sheet here. And this is a solid sheet here. And this is a solid sheet here. So you make the octahedron with four triangles with a single bonded instead of in the tetrahedron, the four triangles are edge bonded, double bonded. Here, this is just a single bonding. And yet they really cover all the whole story. So it goes plus, minus, plus, minus. And that's exactly the way we get into our trigonometry and our trigonometric tables. This being a plus, this is a plus and a minus. So going around any one point. The clock you get going around a point there, looking at it, is plus, minus, plus, minus. And this is your straight trigonometric basis for doing everything. Now, I found it very, very interesting to get into that because then this octant, I'm able to when I was trying to find out how many different relationships existing there, this did come into play in a very big way. Now, next thing I'd like to talk about in that relationship is something that I've come to in numbers. When we do our spherical trigonometry, I'm going to talk about spherical trig a little more. I mentioned it quite a lot the other night, and I pointed out that when we were brought to trigonometry, we were bothered by the idea that sines and cosines, the trigonometric functions were fractions, and that the fractions were seemingly different phenomena, edges and angles. But I've shown you then, if you start with wholeness, you start with the universe and system, then there are the central angles and the surface angles. And one of the things that I discovered that was fascinating is I did those great circles that I showed you. It went from the four great circles, the angles in there, when I spun it, where you went, where a line went altitude of a triangle and altitude of a square and altitude of a triangle, it only went through two sets of vertices when I spun it. Where it went that it would be altitude of the triangle was 54, 44, and the angle, the altitude of the square was 70 degrees and 32 minutes, and the triangle 54, 44 again. We'll just look at those. looking at the electric equilibrium, when I spun it on these six vertices, so the six axi, this one that went altitude of a square, and then altitude of a triangle, to altitude of a triangle. Now, in doing that, we have, I said, this altitude here is 70 degrees, 32 minutes, which is an interesting number, because I'm also familiar with the dihedral angle of the tetrahedron. And this was 54, 44, and this is 54, 44 again, altitude of the triangle. Those numbers are interesting. If I think about 60 as being the normal angle, so let me take 60 in relation then to 54, 44. And that's 6, and 5 minus 4 is 1, and 9 minus 4 is 5. And there we are, 5 degrees and 16 minutes. 2 times 5 degrees and 16 minutes would be 10 degrees and 32 minutes. So it's very interesting. 60 plus 10, 32 is 70, 32. So if I use 5 degrees and 16 minutes as a basic increment, this one is saying minus 1, plus 2. So it goes plus 2, minus 1, minus 1. Plus 2, minus 1, minus 1, so it goes around. That I found very typical. And when we went then from this first phase of the electric equilibrium to where I made the, we got this set of the six great circles, which you did get from this. When I did that, you find it dividing the surface of the, there's also, the three great circles, which are those of the cube, and the three great circles of the cube come about from the three square faces, and they do this. They never get into the triangles, they only get in the squares. Now, I found it very, very interesting to get into that, because then this octant, I'm able to, when I was trying to find out how many different relationships existing there, this did come into play in a very big way. Now, next thing I'd like to talk about in that relationship is something that I've come to in numbers. When we do our spherical trigonometry, I'm going to talk about spherical trig a little more. I mentioned it quite a lot the other night, and I pointed out that when we were brought to trigonometry, we were bothered by the idea that sines and cosines, the trigonometric functions, were fractions, and that the fractions were seemingly different phenomena of edges and angles. But I've shown you that if you start with wholeness, you start with the universe and system, then there are the central angles and the surface angles. And one of the things that I discovered that was fascinating is I did those great circles that I showed you. Went from the four great circles, the angles in there, when I spun it, where you went, where a line went altitude of a triangle and altitude of a square and altitude of a triangle, it only went through two sets of vertices when I spun it. Where it went that, it the altitude of the triangle was 54, 44, and the altitude of the square was 70 degrees and 32 minutes, and the triangle 54, 44 again. We'll just look at those. Looking at the electric equilibrium, when I spun it on these six trial vertices, so the six axi, this one that went altitude of a square, and then altitude of a triangle, to altitude of a triangle. Now, in doing that, we have, I said, this altitude here is 70 degrees, 32 minutes, which is an interesting number, because I'm also familiar with the dihedral angle of the tetrahedron. And this was 54, 44, and this is 54, 44 again, altitude of the triangle. Those numbers are interesting. If I think about 60 as being the normal angle, so let me take 60 in relation then to 54, 44. And that's 6, and 5 minus 4 is 1, and 9 minus 4 is 5. And there we are, 5 degrees and 16 minutes. 2 times 5 degrees and 16 minutes would be 10 degrees and 32 minutes. So it's very interesting. 60 plus 10, 32 is 70, 32. So if I use 5 degrees and 16 minutes as a basic increment, this one is saying -1, -1, +2. So it goes +2, -1, -1, +2, -1, -1, so it goes around. That I found very typical. And when we went then from this first phase of the electric equilibrium to where I made the, we got this set of the six great circles, which you did get from this. When I did that, you find it dividing the surface of the, there's also, the three great circles, which are those of the cube, and the three great circles of the cube come about from the three square faces, and they do this. They never get into the triangles, they only get in the squares. This begins to make a set of triangles. You see these triangles in here? These are the central angles of those, if we do have two tetrahedra inside of a square, of a cube, to giving it shape. The central angles, those are the angles in here. And those angles, interestingly enough, from the 60 degrees that was outside in the vector equilibrium, and 70, this central here, 54, 44, 70, 32, I found in the next one, what were the inside angles become the outside angles, and the outside angles become the inside angles. As there was a succession of the great circling, things turning inside out. So the surface angles become central angles become surface angles. So I found a hierarchy of this kind of intertransformation going on. I'm going to seemingly switch a little bit here with you now and go into number. So I've been talking about the geometry and we're using numbers, but I came also, I paid a lot of attention in my life to things that often are not too well thought. I would say astrology. I haven't done as much to astrology because I would reckon there's something that makes astrology highly creditable, and so many people get into it. Simply taking women's menstruation, which is a very word monthly, which the word month comes from moon, that is discovering the tides of our earth and the absolute connection of the tides of the earth and the moon and the months. I was quite. There are tides in women. This is perfectly clearly demonstration of the being astronomical effects on human beings on planets. That seemed to be implicit. Therefore, I would say, I think that the people who have done astrology have gotten into too much of the myths that go along with constellations and what constellations are supposed to do in the great azimuth. that what twins do, and what I don't think that is very valid, particularly as I began to find these stars are enormous distances, one behind the other, weren't even the same constellation, but the way you and I happen to sit, we've got that appearance. So that we were taking a blackboard effect, where there was not really such a cartoon in the sky. So I felt that there were too many stories came in there to make me have time to really fathom. I would like to get to be a great astronomer. I'd like to know much more about this. I'd like to be able to use the planetarium to advance, but also take the real distances of two stars and so forth and see what would be the ones that were really having some force in at that time. I think something like that could be done. But the point is, big thing is that I will not dismiss something that my intuition would give me any clue that there could be some, this has good reasons to exist. So much superstitions and so forth. Obviously, walking under a ladder is a pretty stupid thing because people are always working on ladders. That's why there's a ladder there. They're allowed to get something in their head. I think that's a fairly good probability one. But I pay attention to all the superstitions I've been told about on the basis I might someday learn something. And one of the things that really impressed me a whole lot when I was young was numerology. I don't know how many of you ever played games of numerology, but there are where you take them, the letters of the alphabet, and give them their numbers, and you discover some very interesting kinds of combinations of things that happen. And I was interested enough in numerology to really begin to try things out in a mathematical manner. And I'm going to tell you something about that now tonight. This place, we have human beings counting in tens, which is a fairly logical way. You see, you had five fingers and five fingers counting on your hands. There are, however, other people who have counted in 12s. And 12 is a very convenient way to count because the count in your hands, the decimal, doesn't even include the number 3. And just if there are going to be a lot of triangles in the world, and any time the 3 comes in, the number's not going to come out evenly, the calculation. So but it seemed that the people who liked the 12 had a very good reason to have it in there. But the 12 itself didn't include the 5. So that maybe when you get to some other kind of module, it would be better. And then there are, if you just think about the single integers, you have the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And if you did even get into that's the 60 degrees, which is comfortable, that one, prime number 1, prime number 2, and prime number 5, and then prime number 3. Multiply 1 times 2 is 2, times 5 is 10, times 3 is 30. So if you get the number 30 and the number 60, you're going to be able to accommodate the first 4 primes. But it does not accommodate the prime number 7, so when we get into trigonometry using 60 degrees and 60 minutes and so forth, every time the prime number 7 shows up, any division will never come out even. It just automatically throws waves of error into systems. I saw that, interesting, that it was Plato tried multiplying the 7 quite clearly because they're in the notes, but he never talked about it. 7 times, see, for instance, 7 times 360 degrees gives you would somebody do that? I think it's 50-40, isn't it? 25-20. Did it come out 25-20? Try it. So 25-20 is an interesting number because there could be 5-0, 4-0, so, but Plato has, you see the way he wrote about 25-20, which made clear he was trying to possibly bring in the prime number 7 into accommodation in trigonometry. Those kind of thoughts also then appeal to me when I'm trying to find, I've been looking for nature's own comprehensive coordinate system, and that's what I was after, if I could possibly find it. And therefore, certainly it was going to involve number. So I've had to pay quite a lot of attention to number. Then I saw that the... I'm going to give you something really quite interesting. We'll do a little counting here. Now, in the game of numerology, where you give... What they do is to take numbers. You give a number for a name, and you add your integers. And if you get to more than 10, you go, for instance, that 11 is a 2. And you simply integrate the integers. And if you did that, for instance, in the way we count numbers here, this would be a 1, and 1 and 1 make 2. So I'm going to use another color. So this would be a 2. And this would be a 3. This would be a 2, and this is a 3, and this is a 4. 3, 1 and 3 is 4. This is a 5. 1, 4, 5, 6. 6, 7. 7, 8. This would be 8 and 9. And this would be 1, 8, be a 9. And this is 2 and 8, 10. This would be a 1. And 1, 9, 10, that's a 1, and 2, 9 is 11, that'd be a 2. And this would be 2 and 3, that's that. Yes, this is a 2, and this is a 3. So we got, things are not coming out, it's gaining all the time. So I tried doing counting in 11s, and I tried counting in 9s, and tried counting in 8s. I found that, let me just try the 9 now. So this one is a 1, and this is a 1, this is a 1, 9, 10, this is a 1. So 1, 1, 1. 2, 2, 2. 3, 3, 3. 4, 4, 4. 5, 5, 6, 6, 6, 7, 7, 7, 8, 8, 8, 9, 9, 9. That's very nice because it's neither gaining nor losing. If I tried it in 8s, I find it loses 1. And if I try it in 7s, it loses 2. If I try it in 6s, it loses 3. If I try it in 5s, it loses 4. 1 obviously gives you plus 1. 2 gives you plus 2, and 3 gives you plus 3, and 4 gave me plus 4, but 5 gave me a minus 4, and 6 gave me a minus 3, and a 7 gave me minus 2, and 8 gave me minus 1, and then a 9 gave you 0. This is interesting. There seem to be a sort of positive and negative fours that are going on here as effect. But the 9 had a 0 effect. Now, the 9 having a 0 effect was something well known. When my first jobs in business before World War I, when I had an accounting job after being becoming a mechanic, and in this accounting job was the big packing house, armor company, and they had on the meat markets of New York, the wholesale markets, and enormous amounts of foods were being shipped into New York. So the accounting, keeping track of cutting up foods and everything, was a very powerful job for the branch houses. And the auditors came around quite frequently, and the auditors taught me a trick of theirs, which they called out casting out nines. What they would do is to cast out these nines in the input and the answer, and they could tell very quickly whether you made an error. Now, the fact that human beings, and this apparently had been known for a very, very long time, and the more I thought about it, the more fascinated I became, because quite clearly the name nine in our English and Latin, none, and in German, nine, these all mean no, 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 zero. In other words, it must have been known a very long time, because I also said to you the names for the numbers are amongst, in etymology, amongst the old names, the old, and they, nobody knows what they stand for, but it's suddenly that you'd find that the nine is associated with the numbness. This must have been long while ago. And again, I always suspicious around my number world, my geometrical world, because of the realization that the navigators did then hold the great secrets, and the king respected them fantastically. He didn't know where they could do it. So the priest was always being able to give the emperor king something very tricky, and he absolutely guarded his mathematical capability. I don't think there's any question about this, and then it keeps showing up. Anyway, this then began to tell me nature had a way of counting here, which is really pretty interesting, where might really have a zero level. This is zero. And then she has a plus one, and a plus two, and a plus three, and a plus four. Then she drops right down to minus four, minus one, minus two, three, minus four. So she seems to have a system going here of one, two, three, four. Then she drops right down to minus four, minus three, minus two, minus one, zero. This means you're zero. And she seems to then keep this one will go on like that and go on like that. But there's a connection like this. There seems to be a wave phenomenon. This could even double back on itself, just make a bow tie out of it. It could look like this. That's what it looks like. And that is part of a great wave system. We simply have these bow ties to it. I think she's using, and I think nature very definitely using this. This is a number itself. And give me the positive four and the minus four. That again sounds very familiar, along with the tetrahedron faces and with the octant counting and so forth. That's all there is. These are all the faces and all the characters there are. And I'm quite sure this number must relate very much then to the way, what are all the variables of the system? And there are only four, positive and four, negative every time. I find very, very exciting. That's why I said this octant had then great appeal to me when I came to realize the coupler was an octahedron that had these really all the variables were in it completely. In relation to what I've been saying to you and talking about prime numbers, I'm going to give Mehdi, I checked, look at, somewhere in the back here, Mehdi, is a sheet of paper, which I'm not allowed to look at right now. There it is.
Want me to write it on the board?
This one. The bluey. No, you keep it yourself. See, I began to find some very extraordinary things going on in numbers. I began to explore more and more and more. You just sit down and keep it to yourself. saying I was interested in accommodating. If we're dealing in octants, then just mathematically, I don't know whether how much you've looked at trigonometric tables and so forth, your sines and cosines, but if the complementary of the sine is a cosine, and the two together have to keep adding up to 90. So, let's get to a quadrant, this right angle, like it's an isosceles triangle with 90 degrees. This is 45, and this is 45. Any other triangle, well, it's 90 degrees, but say it's a 60, 30, 90. So 30 and 60, you know, 90 and so forth, they're complementaries. But I say you can look in one column or the other column for the sine and the cosine, because these things are exchanged. So the largest number you can get to on the small side is 45. And there on, this is the biggest one. Then you know it's just out in the terms of the small number. And the tables are right there, and simply matter whether you want to use a positive side or the negative, whether you go cosine or sine, so on. Now, this made it very interesting. I said then, I wanted to really accommodate all of nature's transformings. I really have to have all the prime numbers up to the number 45, or else the calculations will come out badly. I need to have a comprehensive dividend that will accommodate all those prime numbers. And it probably ought to have quite a few of some of those prime numbers, because a 2 will show up quite a lot. So I have such a number, and the many has it there, and I call it the Scheherazade number, because I'll explain that to you in just a little bit. Or maybe it'd be fun to see why it's Scheherazade first. I want you to take the prime numbers that are not included, if we're going up to I've got a positive octave and a negative octave in an octahedron. I've got to have both the positive and the negative. I've got the positive side has a 4, 4, and then the other side. So 16, I like all the prime numbers up to 16. Or possibly all the prime numbers up to, maybe up to 18. But let's say up to 16, which takes 2 octaves. So there'd be prime number 7 has been left out, and 11 and 13. 7, 11, and 13, anybody tell you, those are very bad numbers, those crap numbers, and everybody knows to be avoided. 13 is an absolutely awful number. So I want to see, to take these numbers, which the myth makers of the great priesthood made a very bad number. I want you to multiply 7 times 11, very nice, 77. Times 13, 21, 37, 21, 23, 77, 1, 0, 23, 0, 1. Very interesting number, 1001. I don't know why I talked about Scheherazade. Scheherazade, remember, had the 1001 Arabian Nights tales, where she kept telling them stories. This is not great Arabia, where the Arabic numerals are the big story. And I say, let's try, multiply 1001 by 1001. We get 1001, and get a 0, and another 0, and then we get 1001 again. That makes a very interesting kind of number. 1002001. Almost like a binomial. A square plus 2AB says B square. There's a 2 in the middle. 1002001. It's a beautiful symmetry. Lovely number, isn't it? So let's try multiply it 1001 again. So we get 1002001 by 1001. So we get 1002001. Then you move over one place, two places. Now, one times, so it goes to 1002001. So we get 1003003001. Always coming out mirror. Every time it's a mirror. This goes on and on and on. This most extraordinary thing, because suddenly introduces symmetry into number. No wonder they call that 1001. They didn't want anybody to know about those lovely numbers, and makes some very, very extraordinary things. So I find that, for instance, if you want to just take 1 times 2 times 3 times 5, which gives us then the 3 to 1 to 2 is 2 to 3 is 6, and 5 is the 30. Then I just, let's get a second power of 30. So that'd be 900. So I'd like to take the second power of the first four primes times the second power of the next three. And you find you're multiplying the 900 times this number, and you find it comes out again, beautiful symmetry number. And I'm getting a whole lot of prime numbers in here, and it's highly rememberable, what I call sublimely rememberable numbers. They're so symmetrical that you cannot help it. And they actually build up to the center and down the lovely hill. So I found that I found a whole series. As I went on into very large numbers, because I wanted to have, thought maybe I have to have more 17s and so forth, and I began to get into all the prime numbers up to 45, which is, and I have this rememberable number. Now I've got to prove it, because Mehdi has it over there, and it's... I'm not going to have room for it all in this 6. I'll say to you by force, 312-315-8158-158-319-499-960-970-302-608-642-615-613-036-8 million. And read what that number is. Let me have a minute here. You know, the multiplication is simply a dot between the two, the numbers, right? Not decimal. So this is 1 to the nth power, of course, and 2 to the 12th power. It is 3 to the 8th power, 5 to the 6th power, times 7 to the 6th power, times 11 to the 6th power, times 13 to the 6th power, times 17 to the 2nd power, times 19, times 23, times 29, times 31, times 37, times 41, times 43. So it has a very large number of the first 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. The first 8 are very highly accommodating, so forth. So that I'm quite confident this number used as the, if we use this for the circle, or we could even just make it 4 times this number and make it for just one quadrant. One of the interesting things, this number is a very big number. I want you to take how many places there are. 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43. It'd be 3 times 10 to the 42nd power. It's a big number. This number is so big. It's interesting that Eddington at one time, you know, it was Sir James Jeans came out of this number as possibly the most adequate number in the universe. If you take using the diameter of the nucleus of the atom as length, and that is a very, I forgot what it is in relation to the diameter of the electron. I'm talking about the nucleus versus the electron. It's about something like 10,000 times to the electron. So it's a very small number. If I then express the distance, the large radius of our observation astronomically so far, which is 11.5 billion light years, and multiply that, put that into light, to miles, and then keep making that grid down, If I express then this largest measurement in the terms of the diameter of the nucleus of the atom, this number is so I can take it down to 10,000ths of that size. It's that big. This is really quite an extraordinary accommodating number it is. And we find then, as we get into the electron microscopes, we're really finally getting into knowing something about them. When the first picture they ever took of atoms per se, where you could see them, not one atom, but atoms, they had the pin, a needle point, a tungsten needle point. And you could see the shape all right, but it consisted of oranges stacked up. They were little spheres. And they would take it out, and they would polish it and just rub it, and they put it back in. They kept doing it, but it always whole oranges. You could not fractionate one of the little spheres that was close to packing. Other nature always has it in whole atom numbers. She plays the game in whole numbers. That's why your chemistry comes out that way. So I felt that you had to really find a comprehensive quotient that would permit everything to come out absolutely whole number. And this number is big enough to do that, really. So I find it very exciting. I'm giving you more and more evidence, the way I try to look at things, where I must deal with some totally, and both in my countings and looking for the coordination of nature itself and what are the tools we have to employ. And all these things are in synergetics and in really great depth, I assure you. There are 900 pages in synergetics. So the kind of things I've been talking about, we really get at, and we get at, and get at. And I'm hoping that we may be able to get some advanced copies for all of you so that you really can keep on. Because I hope you like what we're talking about enough to want to go on and make models and possibly improve our picture that we have here, because I think we do really have a very important tool for our fellow men and this kind of a meeting that we're having, where I'm really checking with the young world. You have your experience and your lot of information, and I'm quite confident that I'm not misleading you, and that you're able to see how much that agrees with experience you've had, information you have, and find out whether this is reasonable, because I'm really submitting to you a completely different world from the world that the way of accounting that human beings have been employing all the way through. I find it very interesting, again, go to Tobias Danzig's book on Number, the Language of Science, to note then the different languages and what they use for their, quite clearly for their counting system, and where they had a name for the number. They had a name for higher numbers than our number 10. Where we have to say, we say 11 and 12, but that 12, 13 is a 3 and 10, but 12 is a word by itself. So we could say that would. These languages have named 12, but were people who did include a 3 long ago, thinking that that'd be better. So they got into dozens, and you find the French getting up to 16. So you don't say and 7, so you say 17. So I find these would be cardinal numbers. So the different languages had different magnitudes, and I thought very well of the French, because there seemed to be the 16 seemed to be 2 octaves, possibly positive and negative octaves. That seemed to be a very, very valid kind of a concept. But you can see that human beings were way, way back doing a lot of thinking, and these things are manifest in the world of the numbers, which is a very revealing matter. I'm now going to switch again. I want also to remind all of you that making my plans for what I can see still has to be talked about. And I made a good inventory today, having gone out 20 hours. I now can see exactly what I'm up against. And I'm assuming questions that you're all going to be accumulating questions. So that I thought on next Saturday would be the questions. I don't see any use in having questions, so really do submit. So you find many questions you are prone to ask do get answered before you get to the question session. And so that I think it'd be better to have it the last day. So I'm assuming we're going to get quite a little time in next Saturday. We could do 6 hours. I will have some things in reserve if we don't use that up, because I would like to really be sure to get everything possible. I don't think I can get everything in, so I'm going to see what are the priorities and what I could left out, and I'll finish. And sadly, we'll stuff those in if there's any time left over. So I'm not going to tend to answer questions people ask for questions, but I am now going to switch over and going to open up about this chart I gave you. I'd like to get back more to the little human being. Really, so you can understand with me how I happened to really peel off, that this is not noble. It was really the only thing to be done. I actually got to a moment where I was either going to do away with myself or do something like this. And I'd like to get into the strategies that I employ for how the little individual can be effective. Certainly when the little individual tackles this, just finding out about number, these are very powerful tools. And you understand that by looking at big patterns, I get synergetic effects that I would never be able to get as I went at things myopically. And so our society, with all its specialization, was just tending to exclude rather than to include. And the more I included, the more chance I see in the connections. And really, might really be find something of very great power for man. Now, I've given you the grand strategies of great navies, the grand strategies of old city-state, and that is replaced by the line of supply, and then this gets into the goes from the water into the air. The water had limits of continents, but the air had no limits. So that we're in an era where the game of the power structures and of ignorance, it has to be you or me, are being played in a very big way, and they buy the capability to do that with their military mandate. It has to be you and me, therefore we got to get the very best weapons and tools. And so what are you and I, as little individuals, going to be able to do that really will bring this to a halt? Obviously, if you go out and I stand in front of the railroad train, you don't stop the railroad train, does it? Protesting means nothing to me. Activism, I would simply say, is part of a political game, a psychological warfare playing on one trying to upset the other kind of economy. So as far as you're really stopping anything goes, I don't think it stops anything. I do think it's educational, and everything goes on in the universe, I think, is the way it ought to be. So I think that these things happen, and I credit everything that happened. I'm glad it happened. That's the way it did, but I don't think it gets positive effects. It may stop negatives, but it doesn't make positive. I'm deeply impressed with Mahatma Gandhi's passive resistance, while it could then really break down the enemy's offensive side, it could not really feed, or did not produce, didn't solve the problems of the poverty. So this is why I'm sure that Nehru became very interested. I think I told you about meeting with Mr. Nehru, and did I tell you that? In 1958, I was speaking in New Delhi, and I spoke three times in the same day. One first on Austrian architects, and then engineers, and then in some artists with a third group in the evening. And at all three sessions, Mrs. Indira Gandhi. And at the last session, I gave her a 10th secretary. I'd been introduced to her in the first of the morning session. I was tremendously impressed that she appeared three times that day. I gave her a little 10th secretary structure to take home. And she said, Would it be possible for me to come on Saturday to meet her father, Mr. Nehru? I had been planning to go to see the Taj Mahal and that day, and I had been planning to go to the Taj, I'll just not do that. So, well, if you can, don't tell my father that you did that, because he doesn't like people who come to India and don't go see the Taj. And you know, I said, I'll see it another time, so it makes up for the deficiency. So, anyway, we did meet. And when I might as well really tell you a little about this, because I told you about the meeting with Einstein, and these people are very fascinating to meet. Mr. Einstein had extraordinary quality about him. I still don't know how much was psychologically within me, but I really felt very much in the presence, and you know, almost an aura of the man. Mr. Nehru came home from the parliament to see me. I talked with Mr. Gandhi all morning. I had my maps, and we had them out on the floor, the parlor floor there. And he finally came, and he came to the doorway, and she introduced me to him, and he never came any further than the threshold of the door, the main door of the parlor there. And she said, please explain your philosophy to my father. So I said, I have a strategy which is other than political, and I know how extraordinarily well informed you are in the world of politics. And I explained that I had a policy where instead of trying to solve problems by political reforms or laws, any reform of man, I was interested in reforming the environment, because the environment itself is continually reforming itself. I said, there are options, and I can participate in it, and if I can bring about a favorable environment by virtue of producing artifacts, I must never use words, I must actually find a tool that solves the problem, makes what is going on obsolete. As I gave you the other day, a bridge over a roaring gorge, and people need something on the other side instead of having to keep risking their lives crossing through the roaring gorge, they'll all spontaneously use a bridge. Unless people die, and they'll get what they need more readily. So I said, this is my strategy, and I felt that it was the objective side of the Nehru's coping with the negative, the subjective side. And I talked to him possibly 25 minutes. I didn't have my watch out, so I can't tell you, but it seemed to be kind of that magnitude. And he stood all that time like this, facing absolutely straight ahead, not looking at me. There's no way for me to get anything from his eyes. It was very strange to talk to a man standing like that. He was in his beautiful white kutta and hat. And finally, I said, I think I've said it all. And so he just went out. And I met him, of course, later on again. But I was told by other engineers and scientists that he had done that with them. I've not heard that he was doing it with other people. But apparently, when he really wanted to hear you, really cared, this was his discipline of his body. He was absolutely listening. He made it clear to me in further meetings. He hadn't missed one word that I said. He had it absolutely straight, clear. It was amazing how this man coming from the parliament, I don't know what was going on, all kinds of political messages of that kind of a life, and to suddenly give himself like this, he really addressed himself to me. In years after this, Mr. Gandhi said, whenever you come to India, and particularly New Delhi, the house is, be sure to telephone right away and let us know you're here. And I have done so ever since. And there came a time, there was one meeting we had and they were in Lake Kashmir, beautiful place of the Vale of Kashmir, and he'd gone there to rest, and I had a number of things I had written with me. When I talked to him that day, I said, you just have words, and you're here to rest, so I better stop talking. He said, I like your words. was a man of very few words, but when he said, you really felt them. And when I was leaving, he took me out. We were way out on the hillside in the car, and they took me into the house, and I was very into Krishna Menon was coming to call, and then he introduced me to him. But on the way out, I had these things with me, the reprints of magazines. And I said, I have with me a number of things that I've written, but I don't believe you have time to read them. He said, I read every word of yours I can get hold of. Now, I say, very few times did he speak to me, but when he did, he would say something just as I got. There came a day when I got to Dunelli, and I called up the secretary, Mr. Gandhi, and the secretary called back in just a couple of minutes and said, would I please come right over? And I went over to the Prime Minister's house, and they have a number of little anterooms. I find myself in different rooms as I come into those houses. And she came in very quickly, and she was eyes and tears, really. And he said, my father just had a stroke. And you don't, I was very moved that she wanted me to come, but it wasn't as if I really knew her well enough to. But on the other hand, she really didn't she'd been brought up, what's the thing about how she'd been brought up? Her father in prison most of the time, political prisoner, and some of the time she's in prison. And he was all her education, he did all her education from the prison. His book on world history is a very great work on world history, but it was the book he wrote, and it was to put together the letters he wrote to his daughter. She was brought up by him, by extraordinary writing. And she'd been Mahatma Gandhi's flower girl, but she'd been in the world of politics all her life, and really didn't have anybody too close in there. She was married, had two sons, her husband died. So I said, trying to think what you'd say to the lady, the father just had a stroke, great man. I said, if your father were not to recover, or if he were even to die, would you try to carry on his political work? He said, oh no, I would not think of doing so. I really have no aptitude. I couldn't be more familiar with that world. That's not my world. I mean, my best to be my father's companion and to carry on in that kind of way, but as for taking any political initiative, I don't have it in me at all. This is a very important thing to hear from her under those circumstances. I don't think the question had ever come up. Because later on, when he did recover from a while, he did get back in Parliament, then later on he did die. But when he did die, the Congress Party, which he and others put together, was an extraordinary accomplishment. Because England left them, and I gave you divide and conquer. Nothing could have been more divided than India. It was an extraordinary thing to be able to get a party that would really hold together. And he had great genius there. When he died, there were his political operatives and other ambitious men who would like to take over. So they thought they could carry on fine, but they found they couldn't. Things became quite clear. The Congress Party was really going to break up completely. The only thing that could hold together would be just the name. So they asked Indira if she would be willing pro tem to be acting prime minister till they had the next election, something to hold things together. So she said she was willing. And when I heard that she'd done that, I thought about what I'd heard her say under those extraordinary conditions, that I'm possibly the only person in the world that knew that she was not going in there for any political ambition. She was going through absolutely her dedication to her father and Mahatma Gandhi to their philosophy. So she went in as a housekeeper, and she'd been in there that way ever since. Every time I go to India, I see her. She usually gives me, at least she likes to have me around an hour or so. And I sat with her as the Pakistani first had their first air attack on India at that time. I've been in some very critical moments there. But she'd like to have me there, and she'd like me to really talk about other things. I was asked to give the third Nehru Memorial Lecture. And I can't remember what that year was now. It was half a dozen years ago, possibly 8 years ago. I've had very interesting experiences in India. That came about by talking about that because I was talking to you about my grand strategy and the idea of developing artifacts. And I saw there's nothing to stop a little individual from developing artifacts, and particularly if you really can see what some of the big problems are. Now, one of the big problems was, quite clearly, I had become excited by my Navy experience and realizing that we were doing more with less, and the more with less of the Navy was what they call high secret. This is the most highly classified information in the world. What you could do more with less, more with the same or more with less when it came to contact. And I realized the more with less, you got where a little airplane was then sinking, big battleship. And it could be, I said, that Malthus was really wrong. He didn't know the foods would be preserved. I spoke about that the other day. So I also then saw that there was a possibility of doing so much with so little, we might be able to take care of everybody. And the whole raison d'etre of politics themselves, war, weapons, would actually be obsolete. This seemed to be something to really shoot for, the little individual, because I saw it was full of soft spots, because nobody's ever taken what they call this weaponry. I invented the word called livingry. Nobody's trying to see what was happening to care of livingry, because they said there's never enough to go around, so money just doesn't get spent that way. It's just useless. It only gets spent in this negative way. Nobody's really said, what do you need for human beings? Nobody's ever spelled it out. So this particularly came then to the weights I knew of buildings. I saw that man was using incredible amounts of material, and that there was no science in it. It was beautiful, skilled craftsmen, but the architect had designed the building in various shapes, and he had to be fairly well informed of something about corbelling and so forth, but he did not have to lay the bricks. The craftsman made the thing work out there, following his shape. And he was doing shapes that a client said he wants this way, very, very much. And so I said, it is a possibility in the direction of livingry, and particularly in the environment controlling the shell and the equipment that goes in that takes care of our various chemical processes and energy needs, there's a possibility this could be really cut down quite far. So you can understand then, by great luck, getting out of the Navy, which had taught me so much there, I had, first before World War I, I'd been also, when I got out, I went to Harvard, and I was looking forward tremendously to going, and when it all happened, I got into a social nonsense of coming from an expensive preparatory school with very rich boys. My family were not rich at all. My mother and my father was really just able to get me there to pay the tuition and rent and a very small allowance. And I found myself not being able to join clubs and things like that. Anyway, things, one reason or another, a love affair that didn't go right and this and that, I got myself quite unhappy, and then I got perfectly good marks, no trouble at all. But I was really feeling I was there for athletics and fellowship and things. I was not gone there with the idea really of getting education. I've already made it fairly clear to you my feelings about mathematics, for instance. While I was still in the preparatory school, I was working afternoons and I had to stay in. I had already gone quite far into college and university mathematics. When I got to Harvard, I didn't take mathematics at all, because by this time I really caught on a lot of patterns. And I was pretty sure that I could just read my own mathematics. I didn't need to have to go. And I assumed that I didn't take the things that I knew a lot about, and I took the things that I didn't know about. So I took musical composition and things like that. Anyway, I took government. I wasn't really interested in, I had never been interested in government, but I took government, which was a good idea. But anyway, in no time at all, I found myself in pain, and I cut all my mid-year exams, and so they had to expel me. That's like a little bit of nonsense in here. I had been quarterback on my football team at my preparatory school, and the quarterback just before me came to Harvard quarterback, and the quarterback before him to Harvard. So I had a good chance, I thought, to be quarterback. I busted my knee, everything all went to pieces on that. I didn't have that to go on. And many, many other things seemed to keep coming up. I certainly wasn't going to be taking any clubs, because I didn't want to be outdone by my friends. And my sister had been married that year that I went to Harvard, and she'd gone on the honeymoon. She had a beautiful Russian wolfhound, and she asked me to take care of it in Cambridge to the kennel. And I found I could do something wonderful. I could take my Russian wolfhound and go to the theater where there's some very popular actress, and I could stay outside the stage door with my Russian wolfhound. She'd always stop, and I could get talking to them and get somewhere. So I'd take Mitzi, and I went to the stage door of the passing show in 1912, and there was a very attractive girl who was called the premier dancer, and her name was Marilyn Miller. She was unknown at that time. And so I used to take her out, and her hired mother and Mitzi, we'd go with the Russian wolfhound and her hired mother, so we'd have dinner. It was not a very cozy affair, but anyway, she then, her play had tried out in Boston, and it was a success, and they were going off to New York. So this is when the midgets came along, so I simply went down to New York with them, and I took my whole second half year's allowance, and I invited the whole chorus of the Winter Garden out to dinner. And I didn't know what to do these girls, I assure you, but at least I had them there, and I could really say to my classmates, this is really, I'm really outplaying you altogether here. I say nothing could be more childish and stupid in a sense, but I was extraordinarily young and naive at that point in my life. However, this then got me out and got me in learning to be a millwright. I was sent to Canada to work in the cotton mill with some Lancashire Englishmen who were putting up the cotton mill machinery for a brand new factory, a cotton mill. And it was a fascinating experience. And I learned to put up one of each of the different kinds of cotton mill machines myself. And I kept notebooks and so forth, and everybody said, this boy done so well, Harvard invited me to come back again. So I did go back. And I went through the same thing again and got out and went down. This time I worked for the packing house of Armour and Company in New York. And I worked in 28 branch houses of Armour and Company, with the markets open at 3 in the morning, and you work till maybe 5 or 6 o'clock at night. It's a very long day. I had this experience of pre-morning New York at all the different, all the, you know, going way up in Chester, Westchester, everywhere. There are 28 different branch houses over the city. And I really got knowing New York and what feeds it. So it's a very extraordinary experience. And then World War I came along, and I went off to the war, went off to the Navy. But then when the war was over, by then I was regular United States Navy. But then our first child was born just the last year of the war, just at the time of the armistice, and she caught flu, and then infantile paralysis, and then spinal meningitis, and we had a long battle to her. She died just before her fourth birthday. And this is a very, you can imagine how we felt about this. And she had been all the more endearing. She couldn't move around, her mind and brain, not damaged at all, but unable to move like other children. And she asked, we found her demonstrating this extraordinary capability, because she couldn't get out to touch things with her own hands, as every other child wants to. She had to get information about things through other human beings in the room. And around it, we had two train nurses, one with this one and the other, and my wife, one of us, be on duty all the time, very often two of us in the room together. And this little child was so sensitive to us that we'd be about to say something to each other that would be to do with our grown-up things and not really this little child. And just you had the words all formed on your lips, and she'd say it. You'd look at astonishment. And I began to really realize that all human beings have something in them that once in a while you say, the only way I explain that is telepathy. We all have those experiences. But we've also learned to shun things you can't explain, and that's not scientifically accredited, so it's not well looked upon. But I felt that quite clearly nature has what we call fail-safe alternate circuits, all kinds of alternate capabilities. So when this thing doesn't work, so we all have this telepathetic, but don't usually use it very much. But this little child had nothing else to get her information, so it was highly developed. Anyway, this made me accredit telepathy as being something probably in due course to be known. We know exactly it's ultra-high frequency electromagnetics. But for the moment, it's inexplicable, I said. Anyway, my feelings about this little child were incredible. My wife was the oldest of 10 children. Her mother died the same year our child died, and one of her brothers was killed. It was a very sad year. She then stayed at home with them while looking out, and I went on with an activity outside in the building world, and both in New York where she was, but mostly I was away, and I had a big operation in Chicago and Boston and Washington and other places. Anyway, we were five years of a. Yes, and then suddenly our second child was born in 1927. And we'd been trusted with a new life. It was a very extraordinary moment. During those interim years, I drank a lot. I worked fantastically hard on what I was doing, but lived a very rough life. And I got to know Al Capone through his stopping. I had a factory in Joliet, Illinois, and I go out there every day from Chicago, and he had a big bar on the way in from Joliet, so I used to stop there. But I've had some very extraordinary kind of experiences in my life, and this was when this new child was born, all this sort of negative, I'd been really trying to bury hurt and feelings, and I got really where I'd gotten. Quite a lot of people that love me and really a lot of rich young friends who wanted to back me when I went in the building world in 1920, when I came out of, I had to resign from the Navy because of the imminent death of my first child. I went back in the armor company, and in the armor company I became assistant export manager for armor company. And that was a very beautiful big pattern experience. And incidentally, in the Navy I had this big pattern experience where I'd become, after a quick short course in the Naval Academy, I became aide to Admiral Gleaves, who was in command of the cruise and transport force operator. I think I mentioned that, 130 ships moving across the Atlantic. But the pattern of handling big patterns was very, very important. I'll also connect that with you, the fact that I was born very cross-eyed. And I mentioned to you the other night about that, they know why the cross-eyed. And not until but they said, don't, we must have fooled around, eyes are very, very delicate. We have to wait till the child is four, and then there's no chance the muscle will be strong enough to straighten the eyes out. And so after four, I was taken to the eye doctor for the first time, and found I was very, very farsighted. And therefore I got my glasses, so I mentioned that to you the other day, that I really had two almost a second birth, a new set of seeing capabilities, such a high order compared to the first three, which I also made clear the other day. That is a very, very big jump. And I'm sure that's had a lot to do with my life. At any rate, my father also died when I was very young, and I'm sure that had a lot to do with my life, because I was brought up then by my mother, and people who would give advice and all these people saying, never mind what you think, really listen, this is the way the game goes, and I did everything I could to learn to play a game. not to do my own thinking. So we have this moment when, after I, just a time of the death of the child, I'm still an hour coming in, and I, my father-in-law had invented a very interesting method of building. He was an architect, a very good architect. And I thought this ought to be, nobody's producing it, and I felt strongly about doing so. A lot of my friends backed me going into this building business, and then I did get up, did get five factories going in different parts of the United States in those years between 1922 and 1927, when the first child died and the second child was born. And I did get up 240 buildings. Of, there were large residences, small and might be a very large commercial garage or something, relatively small buildings, but 240 of them, and all through the eastern United States, nothing west of Mississippi, but gave me enormous experience in the building world, and I'd like to just talk about that for a minute. We are going a little late tonight, but I want to get in enough time, so I'm going to finish some of this particular thinking about why I did what I did and how I organized myself. In the building world, I found then, first place, the method of building we had was very attractive, absolutely novel, and might as well tell you what it was. It was a method of making, first place, I had to develop the manufacturing way to do it. We made fibrous blocks. And these fibrous blocks, I used wood excelsior. You've seen packing excelsior. And I had an enormous rotating machine and shredder and so forth, and we covered it with a very evenly spreading on the fibers, also like pulling spaghetti out of a pile, throwing hay up with a hay fork, wetting each of these pieces with what they call magnesium oxychloride cement. And this we got all of it beautifully just wetted on the surface, and I blew them together and felted them together in a mold. And they made a block form 16 inches long, 8 inches thick, and 4 inches high, with 2 4-inch holes on 8-inch centers, so that when you put a block to the other end, the next hole would be 8 inches away from the end hole of this block. And so the holes, as I say, were 4-inch holes, quite large in an 8-inch block. So there's about 2-inch wall between the hole and the outer side. These magnesium oxide chloride treated fibers then firmed up, became very, 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 very rigid, and gradually they literally petrified. But a very interesting behavior was that they were very light. They weighed somewhere between 2.5-3 pounds each. They were so light and strong, like a felt hat, you could throw them up to scaffolding to be laid. And they were laid end to end. And then we had, using wires, formed something like croquet wickets. A croquet wicket, but when you came to the foot, it went out just about 3/4 inch. And these croquet wickets were 12 inches this way, 16 inches this way, and 4 inches across the top of the wicket. 4 inches across the top of the wicket. They would go down through the holes, joining blocks. But you put them in upside down the other way, transversely of the wall, so they had 4 wires, 2 going longitudinally in the wall and 2 crosswise like that. And they were put in, and then we mixed a very fine concrete with a fine gravel and poured the column up to, leaving one block open. We laid every time 4 courses, but you leave one course open. So that, excuse me, we laid 3 courses, and the wickets were 4 courses deep, and so they overlapped the course below. So the wickets then, we left the last top unpoured, so then we put 3 more blocks. The wicket from above would lap down into the one below before you pour it, so that at every, the wickets overlap each other, the wire 4 inches, I found that this is equivalent, the bond of it in the cement was equivalent to being continuous wire. So I had reinforcing both inside the wall and longitudinally in the wall. And then we didn't, when we laid out the blocks, we didn't put any cement in between them, because they just laid up dry. And then where we poured concrete, when we came to a window, we had girth blocks, and we poured a beam to cap the columns. And then we had beams above the windows, and we had beams above the openings. And then every floor height is a continuous beam heading all the columns. This is another kind of pouring block. And we could lay these up so fast, you'd lay up a whole floor of the house in a day, sometimes a whole house in a day. And to put up the cement is wet, so we had wooden bracings and so forth, so the wall would not move while it's setting up. Then when it was set up, we then plastered the inside and we stuccoed the outside, so that this fibrous block became a beautiful bond for stucco or plaster, and the interior plaster and the exterior stucco were only united by completely flexible fiber, so the expansion and contraction inside and outside were very different, so the wall didn't tend to crack, tend to be a very beautiful wall, and we found that the blocks had the fact they were equivalent to 4 inches of cork in their insulation value. And you could put rotots on it, and all it could do was just charred away, absolutely just a red dot. As I said, gradually these blocks petrified. And I've been to some of the houses in recent years, and it's absolutely just pure stone fibers. So it was a beautiful, beautiful fireproof, beautiful insulation, a wonderful bond for the plaster and so forth, and you build very fast. And they were relatively low cost. And so my friends were excited by it, and they all thought they could make a lot of money by backing me. And my father had always a prominent architect, and many architects, very great architects, thought it was very beautiful. So it did get into a great many very, very special residences of very rich people. And they made very good houses. But when I then was going, when the architect said, I've got to use your material, and the owner said he liked it fine, I then would have to go around to the architect's office and show them how they designed their walls and give that kind of service. Then came the time when the house was all designed, and the architect would then put the drawings out for bids to contractors. And the contractors see this and they say, I can lay this up brick very easily, so I never saw this thing before, I'm just going to lose money on it, and so I know how to do this better. So they didn't like it at all. I would have to go out to probably be 5 contractors bidding it. I'd have to go out to their place and go to the estimators, go over what it would cost, an extraordinary service I had to give them. And I had to practically promise the contractor I'd go out and lay it up for him when the time came, but to be sure that if he ever bid favorably. So sure enough, going out, we're going to build it, all right, and the contractor's giving his bid. Then came problems with insurance companies, so I had to go to that. Then it came to problem, there was no code that allowed it in that town. There was not a town in America that would allow it. I would have to then, finding this rather prominent client and an architect, they'd be able to get me somebody they knew in the town council, so they'd let me have a hearing in the town council after appear there. And then they would say, well, we'll give you a special permit provided you have tests made at a particular university. So I'd have to make up a test wall and let that cure, and we'd test in the university, and sure enough, it had the strength we said it had. And so finally came to the to build. And so they gave me an order for 2-3 truckloads of this. It wasn't really worth very much. By this time, you'd use up any possible profit you could make, and an incredible overhead. So then I found that we got the job, and the carpenters said this is form work. Therefore, it belongs to us. The mason said, obviously, these are blocks. This is masonry. So if the mason put it up, the carpenters went and pulled it down. And if the carpenters put it up, the mason pulled it down. And the lathers said, it's lath. So they didn't like it. So it was nothing but jurisdictional disputes. This used up more money. Anyway, out of the 240 buildings I was able to get up, I assure you that there was just I just couldn't make money. And when it was all over, and I had to have special insurance, and had a special, the banks didn't like the for mortgages and things. When it was all over, I had to start all over again. There was absolutely no momentum for the thing you'd done before. None. Only incidentally, because it looks so inflammable, this white, the oxychloride cement did not give the wood color. It just looked kind of wood. It looked like it's just any bale of packing cells are going to burn up like that. So I used a carbon black powder, and it made it gray. It looked like concrete blocks. Anyway, the Celotex company bought it, and there's never been anything that was quite so good as sound absorbent. So there's a material called Soundex. You see many places where you see those fibers matted. That's the material I developed for that building. So I'm leasing my stuff around. And it sold out to Celotex, and I was really out, and I was penniless, and my friends did not think well of me, the people who at least were trying to make money. A friend is a friend, so there were some friends left all right. But I was in anything but high repute as a businessman, and here was this new child. So I'll tell you, and I had been doing all this drinking and everything like that, and suddenly it was a new, entirely new kind of life. And I really felt at that moment that I'd had really by good luck of getting out of Harvard, I'd had an acceleration of experience. I really had much more experience than my contemporaries. And I, however, felt that I'd made such a mess of things that I didn't really like to try to make money anyway. I wanted to build a good wall. I'd like to make a good material. I really wasn't interested in the money side. And I was having to play a very much of a game there, and was not good at that. And so I said, I just quite clearly am a mess, and I thought then that maybe my mother was not well off. She was well off for just a single woman. And I said, my wife's family and my mother might be able to take better care of my kids than my wife and my daughter. Maybe I better get myself. I just seem to be a mess. I really felt tremendously messy, I assure you. And so I really contemplated very much suicide, not contemplated. I actually decided how to do so. And I got into then the thoughts about what is a human being? What are we? We're going to do away with this. What are you doing away with? I said, one thing I've been doing away with is very little experience. And I really learned an enormous amount of my experience, I assure you. And the fact that I didn't make money didn't mean that I hadn't learned my technology superbly. And I learned enormous patterns of how people get things done. And I've been through getting those five factories going, five different cities, people putting up money, enormous amounts of legal work and patent work and so forth, very familiar with those kind of things. And I was very familiar with the business world's way of looking at things. So I said, well, each one of us is some kind of an inventory of experience. And I said, I do not really think that we own ourselves, that we are here by virtue of others. And I said, it could be that my experiences could be of value to humanity. So I said, there's only one condition for you not getting rid of you. As far as you for you goes, you've got to get rid of you for you. You're only entitled to stay alive if you really commit yourself and all your experiences to other human beings in a very, very complex and complete out-and-out way. I told you how much best I have a principle, so that this idea of precessionally going off 90 degrees did not seem to be illogical to me. In fact, it seemed very logical, but it's never been tried, and so all my contemporaries are tied up with have to earn a living. And I said, I think this is just what we ought not to be doing. We ought to be saying, what did my experiences teach me needs to be done, which, if not done, will find world society in great trouble, which, if attended to, will find them in advantage. And what would I need to know in order, above what I now know the Navy sees as that assault, what more would I need to know in order to be able to do something effective about it? I said, those are the kind of questions I thought we ought to be doing. And I then also then came to ask myself quite a number of other questions. And I said, the only condition then of your saying is that you are committed to the others, and number one, you have to do your own thinking. Everything that's happened to you really relates very much to your accepting other people's thinking, trying to play games that you didn't have your heart really in. So that this is going to be a very new kind of discipline. And you're going to have to be absolutely trustworthy that you really are committing yourself to other people. There's no cheating on this thing. Not just this way you arrange not to kill yourself now, and then you're going to start cheating on this. You're going to have absolute conviction that you'll be able to carry through for your full lifetime. Well, I asked myself quite a number of things, and number one, I said, all right, you've experienced an enormous number of human beings who are deeply moved by their religions that they've been taught by their families. They belong to very large, great religions, a great fervor. And I said, all right, I've got the number one question you're going to have to ask yourself is, if you're going to do your own thinking and give up, this means giving up all belief. And I've been taught to believe various things. I accept them more or less wholeheartedly. I said, I'm going to have to give up all those things. I've got to start absolutely from experience, experiential base. So I said, do you have any personal experiences which give you reason to have to assume some greater intellect operating in the universe than that of man? I said, I'm just overwhelmed by the evidence of that. These generalized principles themselves, which can only be intellectually just detected, and they're utterly intellectual. They're weightless. A generalized case is absolutely intellectual. And there's an integrity. All these principles are all interaccommodative, so that I'm overwhelmed by an a priori greater intellect operative. I'm going to talk more about this on Friday, but I just want, that was very much one of the important questions right at the outset. So I said, then I'm going to assume that I really, in doing my own thinking, I'm going to try to understand whether I am really, whether a great intellect is worthwhile for me to carry on. And what would be the requirements of a comprehensive integrity of our universe? Because it's looking out for all humanity, looking out for the universe. Why do we have these generalized principles? What is the universe itself trying to do? I said, I'm going to have to learn to ask myself some very big questions. I'm going to have to answer them myself from experience. Now, suddenly, one little human being going to see what absolutely penniless, dependent child, wife and child, and trying to commit himself in such a big program as that, and everybody's saying you've got to earn money. I assure you that my family and my wife's family and all of our friends was that I was being really very treacherous to do such a thing. And it was not easy to carry on. And there's nobody to tell you what to do, nobody to mark your paper. You had to really set out, you've got a commitment of how to solve problems by artifacts. And what are the first artifacts have to be done? Well, luckily, there had been that Navy experience. There had been the doing more with less of the sea. There had been the doing more, even more with less of the sky. And then getting in this building world where things are going absolutely opposite, and heavier and bigger and heavier and higher, the more secure. That's the way the people are thinking. I saw incredible ignorance that was dominant in that world. Therefore, the artifacts that have to be produced would be, how do you then give man such high performance? And I particularly have said, I'm going to surround and give life, commit myself primarily to the young life, to the newborn, where there are no conditioned reflexes. Trying to arrange the environment controls that will make it possible for that young life to be well protected, but to be able to get all the information it really needs, to be able to carry on in a very logical way to employ its brain. So coordinate the feeling of its senses, information in its senses. So you can begin to see how the grand strategy began to shape up. Suddenly I said, I've heard people always trying to talk to other people, persuade them to do this and that. I must never from now on, I have so little time, if I ask people to listen to me, they're not going to listen, and your life will be gone. You must not talk to anybody unless they ask you to talk to them. I said to you that the other day, but very fine principle. And you must not talk about your artifact that you think will work until you literally put it, designed it, actually made it, tested it, and find out whether it works. Then if it works, then the people say, what is that? Then I have an obligation to tell them what it is. And people then ask me, then I must give them my best. I must not have just a short moment. We're now coming really to time to stop tonight, and I would have to say some more about this, the grand strategy in that moment, but I don't want to have to come back to that moment very much more. Once you understand why it really was enough to be a real turnaround. It had to be absolute turnaround. I've often said about friends of mine that I'm very, very fond of, that been brought up with money and wealth and really charming human beings and very loving and lovable, and yet they get drinking and being wasting and so forth. And I often say if they could get in enough trouble to really hit bottom, then they might really get somewhere. But it is pretty difficult to get enough trouble just to do that, or not just to stay in trouble and so forth. And right, I think I represented that the world was in a state evolutionarily where certain things had to be done, and there'd be a Mr. X or Mr. Y would come along at a certain moment to do certain things. That I simply happened to fit into a Mr. X position, that I was and needed an average healthy human being and nothing else. I did not want genius, except that we're all genius. But somebody who could somehow or other be so committed that we then would be able to recapture the sensitivities we had. So I apparently just about qualified through getting enough mess to be Mr. X. But for all times there, you have to keep me testing, and at my age, I'm sure you have to continually keep asking myself about the disciplines and be sure that it really is out for everybody, and not getting a moment where it's any sort of fun because a lot of friends, people come around and say, I like you. This must not have anything to do with it. Absolutely, I think you really feel with me, being with me these few days, how much I really do feel then the outgoing and the commitment to you. And I really feel quite badly when I'm being introduced and being made Mr. Big. And I have to deflate that just as rapidly as I can on the platform, because that's not the way I feel. I was deeply impressed, especially in my history, whether time and again such people as the Julius Caesar and so forth, beautiful Shakespeare's Julius Caesar and so forth, the individual who was really built some great roads and did make some very important advances for humanity in the accounting systems and one way or another, then suddenly you're going Mr. Big. And yes, I am something special. Therefore, I'm emperor. This is I'm something of God, and I'm something different. I said, you know enough of those things. So you must not go in. If you do what you're doing, it's going to probably open up some very great treasures. But those don't belong to you. I've conducted then a great many kind of projects, as you see, and I've done things to protect them as operations, but not as possessions. I will end just by this patent business, because this comes up from time to time. I don't like to get it out of the way. I've taken a great many patents. I've taken them because, you know, I was demonstrating what a little individual could do that great corporation couldn't do and great states couldn't do, but with great states and great corporations throwing the inference around very, very powerfully. As for instance, when I developed the geodesic domes, I had very extraordinary patents, the same patent attorney I told you who got me the patent on the projection, because the statement had been that it was a pure invention. The same man and took out the Geodesic Patterns. He wrote very good claims. Patterns are only as good as the claims written by that by the patent attorney. And when the geodesic domes came into great need for the radar programs and many other government uses, but particularly radar programs, they're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on them. They found that I had already a structure. They tried everything else out, nothing else would work. And the president of MIT was a physicist in charge of the project of the getting ready the microwaves and the radar system for the early warning system, the DULAN, the defense early warning system. And Wiesner then asked me to produce one of his domes, and I did, of my domes, and he did, and he put it around one of his radars. And if he hadn't done that, we just wouldn't have gone anywhere. But anyway, they hadn't found anything else that did work. And when Wiesner bought my geodesic dome, polyester fiberglass dome, and put up around his radar up in the Lincoln Project roof, the MIT structural engineers then calculated, according to the most favorable analysis for, it's called Chimchenko, for spherical structures, and they found that this structure would disintegrate in a 14-mile-an-hour wind, so they advised the physicists they made a great mistake in acquiring the stone. And luckily, Hurricane Cal came along that year, 1953, and they had wind gusts up to 120 miles an hour, and it was just getting on fine. So the physicists called up the engineers, said, "Look out there and see the sun, because it is not coming apart at this very high winds." So the engineers said they obviously didn't understand it, so they needed to know more about it, so they moved that particular dome to the top of Mount Washington, where they had the highest winds in the United States. And no structures ever stayed on top of Mount Washington until they put that dome up. It stayed there for 2 years. The Air Force has a platform up there. They put structure in that stopwatch to see how many minutes before it blows away. Just regularly. And so suddenly the domes were in, and all the big corporations wanted to be in. So the Air Force had said, I had agreed that I didn't have any money, no capital to produce the domes, so I would license any reputable corporation. And so they said, "You behave so well, we'll protect your patents too." So these on the drawings that went out from the Air Force, they always had and to get the patent license from it. We had really the largest corporation in America all want to get in this program, so that my patent attorney would have the patent attorney of a great corporation coming to see him in New York. My patent attorney told me out of the over 100 patent attorneys from major corporations came to see him to talk about licenses, that at lunchtime or sometime during that day-long meeting, he said, "The first thing my clients had me do was try to get around your patent. The only reason I've come to you is because your claims are so well written. We had to take your license." Which is simply to say to you, if I had not taken out licenses or taken patents, you would never heard of me, because I only got really been known through the geodesic dome. And I knew I'd be absolutely steamrolling. I was working out, this was a big corporation, and any kids who wanted to get a license, I just gave them a license. But the corporation had to really pay royally. All those royalties got spent in more research and so forth. But I do want you to know why I've taken out patents. And I tell other kids, please don't spend your money, because it's very, very expensive. I spent over $300,000 in patents to try to protect these things. I felt this is part of the responsibility of the job I am doing, and not a matter of possessions. So we've come to the end of today. Thank you.